Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The death of George Floyd last year has shown a spotlight on what it means to be black, especially to be dark-skinned in America. Special correspondent Fred DeSam-Lazaro has our report from Minnesota, home to a growing population of African and other immigrants. It's part of our continuing series, Race Matters, and Fred's series, Agents for Change.
Amira Adawe remembers the first time she came to this mall, popular in Minneapolis's Somali immigrant community.
One of the women, I was buying something from her. She said, you know, if you were a little bit lighter, you would have been more beautiful.
This is casually somebody you'd
just
never known
casually,
before.
Casually, yeah.
Being told she'd be more beautiful if she were a bit lighter is nothing new for Amira Adawe. Prejudice against dark skin or colorism is pervasive even where people are dark-skinned, like Somalia, where she grew up.
My mother's friends sometimes will say, you know, like that I am darker compared to my sister. But my mother always used to say she's very beautiful, and so being very protective.
In almost every corner of the planet, there's a huge social dividend that comes from being lighter skinned. Sociologists trace it back centuries to European colonization, slavery, and class or caste. Studies show people with lighter complexions earn more, are less likely to be arrested, and if convicted, serve shorter sentences than people with darker skin. Whiteness is the global beauty standard. It's reinforced in marketing by the multi-billion-dollar business of skin lightening products, hundreds of obscure brands, and some very well-known ones as well. Fair and Lovely is one of the most recognizable brands across South Asia and parts of Africa. It's made by Unilever, better known in America for Dove, Caress, and dozens of other household products. Sociologist Margaret Hunter has studied colorism globally.
In some countries, the names are very overt. White and beautiful, white dream.
Introducing new Olay Whitening Body Wash.
In other countries, including the United States, we use a little bit more coded language, but they are selling the same set of values.
Skin creams have long been marketed to black and brown Americans, but when Adawe arrived here at 19, she discovered that as an immigrant, she was part of a specific targeted audience.
It's not only limited to the Somalis, but also the Asian communities, the Hmong community, and the Latinx communities.
Armed with a master's degree in public health, she started a group called Beauty Well, creating an awareness campaign with the Minnesota Department of Health that warned about skin lightening creams that were tested and found to contain mercury, and a petition drive with the Sierra Club that got 25,000 signatures demanding that Amazon stop selling lotions with the banned toxin.
I was able to deliver these petitions and letter to Amazon, and the following day we learned that they have removed the products off of their website.
But Amazon removed just 15 mercury-laced products, she says. There remain dozens of brands with little, if any, ingredient information sold online and in stores frequented by immigrants. We asked University of St. Thomas journalism student Sophia Muhammad, who is Somali-American, to browse the shelves for us.
The lady who sold me this told me how this product will make me look lighter and makes you look beautiful.
Minneapolis dermatologist Margaret Pierre-Louis says some creams don't work as advertised, others have varying degrees of toxicity, and the most dangerous and very popular, she adds, are steroid-based creams.
Mm-hmm. They have permanent disfiguration to the face. There is now very white patches on the cheeks, and there's broken blood vessels and a thinning of the skin that gives these women horrible photosensitivity, meaning they can't tolerate the sun at all.
Due to both the stigma and isolation of many consumers, it's a problem that gets little public attention.
Only people who had lived experience know.
Most white people are just simply not aware of it.
Yeah.
Adawi has tried to bring a broader awareness, lobbying, among others, Minnesota Congresswoman Betty McCollum.
These cosmetics are coming in basically unregulated. We had 2.9 million cosmetic products were imported in 2016 number. 1% were examined, and 15% of that 1% had contamination or it had illegal ingredients.
McCollum has pushed the Federal Food and Drug Administration to step up its enforcement and also arranged federal grants of $1 million to help programs like Adawi's Beauty Well.
We need to get the inspections up. We need to get these banned.
For her part, Adawi uses podcasts and works with groups of young women to help them understand and fight anti-blackness and the use of skin lighteners in their communities.
Colorism is so much now embedded in cultures, but lately what's happening is more awareness.
Awareness that she says has grown markedly, starting in her own Minnesota backyard after the death of George Floyd.
One of the things we saw that was different, I think, from previous protest moments, we saw a lot of corporations jumping on the bandwagon and wanting to express solidarity.
In the cosmetics sector, Johnson & Johnson dropped a line called Neutrogena Fine Fairness. J&J is a funder of the PBS NewsHour.
Our new level of whitening.
Procter & Gamble pledged to dismantle racism through its advertising, but Olay whitening products are still sold in Asian markets. And Unilever said it would change the name of Fair and Lovely to
Glow and Lovely. Fair and Lovely. Ekon Glow and Lovely.
Amira Adawi is not impressed.
They are still promoting colorism. They still want people to use these products. It does not change the issue.
The cosmetics companies mentioned here declined to comment. Sociologist Hunter says they, like big corporations in general, are increasingly being held to account by a new generation of consumers and dark-skinned influencers.
Solway is going to be read to us by its author, Academy Award-winning actress.
And we see more and more celebrities taking positions, and Lupita Nyong'o wrote a children's book recently to specifically address issues of colorism. As a dark-skinned woman herself, she talked about feeling very isolated.
That rings very true for journalism student Safiya Muhammad.
Although I would never think about even touching any skin lighting products, the effects of colorism and the desire for lighter skin really did impact my self-esteem. It's very toxic, especially as a young person, as a young woman of color. But over time, I've found ways to become more secure in my own skin.
There are definitely signs of hopefulness. But it's not a quick fix. Colorism is connected to the much larger system of racism, and it won't go away until racism is also gone.
One measure of progress Amira Adawi will be looking for is a decline in the still robust sales of skin lightening creams. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Fred DeSamlazaro in Minneapolis.
That report is in partnership with the Undertold Stories Project at the University of St. Thomas in Minnesota.
And they don't want to give black people credit. They don't want to give us any credit. They just want to blame everything on niggas. Didn't some white man in Boston shoot his pregnant wife and then shot himself to my, oh, niggas did it. Always trying to blame some niggas. And they believed the shit. Till the brother couldn't take it or something, and he could jumped off a fucking bridge, right? Then they told. Then a bitch always trying to blame a goddamn nigga. That's why I'm gonna start a new ad, 900 blame a nigga. So when white folks get in trouble, just call my agency. Blame a nigga. I just pushed my mother down the stairs. I don't want to go to jail. Send a nigga over here. All right, I got one on parole. I'll send him right over, ma'am.
We want to take a moment now to remember a comedian and writer whose voice spanned generations.
Ladies and gentlemen, show your love. Give it up for the godfather of comedy, Paul Mooner!
Paul Mooney. He died Wednesday at his home in Oakland, California. Mooney was known as the godfather of black comedy.
What?
The godfather of black comedy, who dealt with race in cutting detail.
Sometimes it's in a joke that you can tell the truth. Mr. Mooney spent years behind the scenes writing on shows like Saturday Night Live and Sanford and Son. His friendship with comedian Richard Pryor started back in the 60s when the two became close collaborators. Here's Mooney hosting the Richard Pryor Roast back in 1977.
When I met him, the first thing I noticed, he was very bright, two shades lighter than me. Since that time, we've become old and dear friends. I'm very dear to him. He's very old to me.
Paul Mooney was one of these guys where you just wanted to sit next to him and just take notes. I mean, he was off the cuff, hilarious, and fearless.
Actor and comedian David Alan Greer worked with Mooney back in the 90s on the sketch show In Living Color, and they used to do stand-up together, too.
Paul performed until they literally took him off the stage. He would just sit on the stool with the mic and his little hat and just riff, you know. He was like the Sgt. Pepper of comedy that you put the needle down in any place on the album, and it was brilliant.
Here's a clip from Mooney's 1993 comedy album titled Race.
This city is a trip. It's hard for a black man to get a cab here. I didn't know this was like New York and everywhere else. Cabs try to run me over trying to pick up somebody white. It's true. You have to hire somebody white to get one for you. Some cold. I learned it all from my grandmother. I mean, I got my sense of humor from my grandmother.
In 2009, Mooney spoke on NPR with our colleague Neil Conan.
Yeah, my grandmother was very funny. You know, she used to sleep with a hammer.
Sleep with a hammer?
Yeah, no, she did. She said, just in case. in case someone broke in or someone came in, she didn't know she had something for them.
Now, at this point, you can be forgiven for saying, I never heard of Paul Mooney. He was often behind the scenes. But you may have heard of Dave Chappelle, who spoke with TMZ after learning about Mooney's death.
I want to shout out every comedian on earth, one of the best that ever did it. His legacy will live forever. Paul Mooney will be sorely missed and wildly remembered.
Man, what an influence. Paul kept it real and kept it true and honest until the end.
Again, actor and comedian David Alan Greer.
Paul Mooney is the one dude who I know I would like to sit next to him at his own funeral. That would be the greatest comedy special ever.
Writer and comedian Paul Mooney died on Wednesday at 79.
You're dirt. We think you're dirt, Paul.
Who is we?
The West. All the superpowers, everything you believe in, Paul. They think you're dirt. They think you're dumb. You're worthless.
I'm afraid I don't understand what you're saying, sir.
Oh, come on. Don't bullshit me, Paul. You're the smartest man here. You got them all eating out of your hands. You could own this freaking hotel, except for one thing. You're black. You're not even a nigger. You're an African.
India has been grappling with a catastrophic surge of COVID-19 cases, and the impact of that is also being felt in Africa. African countries have been counting on a company in India for nearly all their vaccine against the coronavirus, and that company, Serum Institute of India, announced this week that it doesn't expect to export any vaccine until the end of this year. NPR's Nurit Eisenman reports.
When COVID cases surged in Malawi last January, Alinafi Kasia's family was hit hard. His sister was the first to get sick. The disease killed her just before her 44th birthday. She'd been healthy, had a job at a bank, was the heart and soul of their clan.
Oh, my goodness. My sister was everything. You know, in any family, you have that person who is able to connect you with everyone else.
Then another sister, who had cared for his first one, came down with symptoms. Then Kasia's 13-year-old son got sick while at boarding school. Kasia wasn't even allowed to visit him while he recovered.
This is a nightmare. I mean, the whole situation was a nightmare.
And so in March, after the first doses of COVID vaccine finally started reaching Malawi and Kasia got his shot, It felt like a day he'd remember for the rest of his life.
That was like one of the significant moments.
Except the vaccine Kasia got is AstraZeneca, which means he needs a second dose 12 weeks after the first. And right now, it doesn't look like Malawi is going to get any more doses. The manufacturer providing the vaccine, Serum Institute of India, has halted all further exports. Kasia, who is country director for Village Reach, a nonprofit that helps Malawi's government with vaccine rollouts, says he feels like all that relief and hope is being snatched away.
You feel the gains that were made with the first jab will be kind of, deleted. So this was all for nothing.
Across Africa, about 20 million people who are coming due for their second dose of AstraZeneca are facing the same dilemma. And that's not even counting another 140 million who were supposed to get first doses in April, May, June, July. Because African nations were outbid by wealthy countries, practically all of this supply was purchased through an international collaboration called COVAX, which is co-led by the World Health Organization. And practically all of the vaccine that COVAX bought for Africa was from that one same manufacturer that's halted exports, Serum Institute of India. Dr. John Nkengasan is head of the Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, an agency created for the region by African governments.
And now it has thrown us in total confusion as to where we should reach out to get the additional doses of AstraZeneca.
Nkengasan says it's particularly galling because those being left without vaccines are just the highest priority sliver of African populations, healthcare workers, the elderly. Fiona Atuhebwe coordinates the introduction of new vaccines in Africa for the World Health Organization. She says she and her colleagues are exploring, quote, all possible options to cover at least those who are waiting on their second dose. Maybe the interval between the two doses could be safely extended. Maybe they could use a different vaccine for dose two. But she says,
the fastest way for Africa to get extra doses right now, especially of AstraZeneca, is dose sharing by wealthier countries.
She says she's heartened by some recent moves in this direction by France, Sweden, and the United States. But she says much more is needed. Nurit Eisenman, NPR News.
Medical apartheid. The dark history of medical experimentation on Black Americans from colonial times to the present.
The national calls to action and protests over racial justice have brought new awareness of past injustices in many parts of our society. That's true in the fields of science and medicine, which are starting to look more carefully at their own history. Yemi Shalcindor focuses tonight on some of these developments, part of our continuing series on race matters.
The American Medical Association is one of the country's oldest, largest, and best-known associations of doctors. Its voice has long been influential, but now the AMA is finally beginning to come to terms with racism in its own past. It recently issued an 83-page report that found that the organization is, quote, rooted in white patriarchy and affluent supremacy. The report outlines a number of examples, including the group's past support of excluding physicians of color. And it notes that in the 19th century, a president of the group once practiced vaginal surgeries on enslaved Black women without anesthesia. The AMA is vowing to take action on racial justice and health equity. Dr. Aletha Maybank is the AMA's chief health equity officer. She started work on the report 2 years ago. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Maybank. I want to start by saying you did work on this report. Tell me a little bit about what was most troubling to you when you look at what was uncovered and what the report says.
You know, when you start to dig into the history, you're not sure, you know, what you're going to find. And most of the history and some of the points you've already mentioned, you know, many of us knew, or at least those who are connected to this work, had an understanding of the exclusion of Black physicians and the consequence of shutting down five of the seven Black med schools and all the women med schools, which has a direct connection on the lack of diversity today. So to uncover that, you know, and I don't feel we actually have done it to its fullness yet. This was just really more so kind of a more of a taste for us to get to that point and start demonstrating the importance of naming the harms and being an example to start doing that.
And Dr. Maybank, this J. Marion Sims, he practiced vaginal surgeries on enslaved Black women. Talk to me about the harm that was done then, but also the continuing harm, the consequences of that in present day.
As you mentioned, he did slaves without anesthesia on enslaved women. And so it's a representation of how bodies literally were used, were experimented upon, were not valued without any consent, and how that still even translates to some level till today. And so the reality is that women's bodies, Black women's bodies, bodies of other people of color and those who have been historically marginalized are still not fully valued. And that's really what our data and evidence is really showing up. If we look at the COVID-19 pandemic, the data is really telling us that we're not valuing all lives the same way. Everybody doesn't have the power or the resources or the conditions in order to achieve optimal health. And that still is pervasive through our healthcare and our medical system. And so we really wanted to make sure that we were very explicit about that in this report, that we didn't, you know, tiptoe around the edges, as I kind of say, sometimes do soft equity work. But we really named, you know, the root causes of oppression in this country, and really even speaking to and starting to name the impacts of colonization as well as capitalism as just an introduction. And as you can imagine, many of these terms are new to the people in the healthcare profession and make people very uncomfortable. And so, you know, we're trying to find ways to bring folks along while at the same time, you know, being very direct and instructive that this is where we really need to go if we really, really are committed to advancing equity and really committed to racial justice work in healthcare.
There's also this idea that there were physicians of colors that were excluded. There was also the closing of those medical schools catering specifically to Black people and women. How is that showing up in present day diversity issues in medicine?
There's just a tremendous still lack of diversity of having Black physicians and really Latinx physicians, as well as Native American physicians who have been completely excluded still from the medical profession. You know, we are the ones as AMA who commissioned Abraham Flexner. We valued this model of significant scientific rigor and really evaluated schools across the country in the early 1900s and said, if you didn't have that, if you didn't have those types of resources, we didn't think you were a good enough school to stay open, basically. And so that impacted, as you can imagine, many Black med schools that aren't going to be resourced. And so five were recommended to shut down. And in addition, the part that really, I think, really speaks to the impact, at that time, AMA was also excluding Black physicians. And so back then, in order to get licensed to hospitals, you actually had to be a member of the medical society within your local community, which was an AMA or American Medical Association affiliate. So if you couldn't gain membership to an AMA medical affiliate, you couldn't gain a license to work at the local hospital. So now you have Black physicians who also can't find hospitals to work at, which impacts then our communities. You know, we have to take a look at that entirety of the history and its impacts.
There are some who look at this report and say it lacks teeth, timelines, and targets. What concretely does the AMA plan to do, given now the history that is known?
When people say it lacks teeth and targets, and clearly I'm very close to it. And, you know, we've spent a lot of time. We've spent over a year and a half working together to pull this report together. And when you look at healthcare and how far they have not gone as it relates to talking about equity and injustice and using terms such as racism and white supremacy and capitalism, you don't see that in healthcare. And so we really, again, wanted to make sure that this report did go far enough, but we're going to need to have many types of partners in order to help propel this forward. And then more importantly, I think most importantly, is the accountability piece. And I think that's the part where I do accept definitely, you know, criticism or just push. You know, at any institution, especially an institution that is historically known to embody discrimination and racism and perpetuate institutional and structural racism, hold us accountable. And so I absolutely, you know, call upon others in the healthcare community to do that. But not only the healthcare community, all the folks who are impacted by the decisions that we make and contribute to and influence at the policy and advocacy level, but also at the system level of healthcare.
Well, a critical conversation about equity and healthcare. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Aletha Maybank.
Thank you.
What's wrong?
Wrong? Wrong? Wrong? Nothing's wrong.
Well, then how come you're on fire?
Don't answer it.
I beg your pardon.
Don't answer it.
Or may I ask why?
It's a wrong number.
Oh, then by all means, let's not answer it. But I feel I should ask you this, Althea. How do you know it's a wrong number?
It has a different sound. Wrong numbers sound more neurotic because the circuits are confused.
I see.
And it just upsets it if you answer it.
It's strange, but it sounds like a right number to me.
No, you're wrong.
You're nuts. Hello?
Jeff Gerber?
Yes?
Move out, nigga.
After getting two low appraisals for a home she was trying to refinance, an Indianapolis homeowner is fighting back. She wondered if the appraisals were based on her race, so she designed a way to test for discrimination in the housing appraisal process. From member station WFYI, Jill Sheridan reports.
Carlette Duffy's tidy three-bedroom home close to downtown Indianapolis is in a historic Black neighborhood. It's been completely renovated and sits across the street from a park in lush green space. She bought it 4 years ago for $100,000.
My house is my forever home. I love my neighborhood. I love my home.
With a hot housing market and low interest rates, Duffy wanted to refinance her mortgage to help fix up another home for her daughter. The first appraisal came back at $125,000, and she was shocked. A recent independent market analysis had estimated her home at $187,000, so she tried again.
And then to get the second one, and it's $15,000 lower. Just a few months later, I just could not fathom. You know, there was this just nagging voice in my head that was saying that there is something wrong.
Duffy had a theory and wanted to put it to the test. When she applied for refinancing with a new lender, she left her race and gender off the application. One of her friend's husbands, who is white, agreed to stand in during the third appraisal. Before he did, she took out everything that might indicate her race and left her home. She got another shock when she got that appraisal back.
I scrolled so fast and I was just like holding my breath, scrolling and getting to the bottom of it to see the number. I'm just like, I don't even want to read it just yet. I just want to see the number.
The number, $259,000, more than double the original appraisal.
And then it just sinks in. It just set in that what was devaluing my home was me.
Carlette Duffy filed a complaint against two of the lenders with HUD. Neither would comment for this story. But the appraiser with the lowest estimate, Tim Boston, stands by his report.
Anytime I put a report out, I prepare with the intention of having to defend that report before a group of my peers. It's all data-driven, so it's inherent in the data, and I wouldn't know how to change that.
A number of studies have found that Black-owned homes are undervalued when compared to those of white homeowners. This is especially true in historically Black neighborhoods. A study by the Brookings Institution finds that adds up to $156 billion in cumulative losses for Black homeowners. Amy Nelson heads the Fair Housing Center of Central Indiana and says local and federal policies that perpetuated racial segregation in the early 20th century play into the continued disparity.
It was the appraisal industry at the time that supported the very redlining maps that redlined Carlette's neighborhood and so many Black neighborhoods in our city.
Nelson says while it's hard to determine how prevalent the problem is, examples of racial bias and discrimination in the appraisal process have been discussed for years.
Just a growing number of Blacks and African Americans saying something's wrong here.
There also may be a growing desire to address this issue. HUD recently decided in favor of a complaint in a similar appraisal discrimination case. In a written statement, the American Society of Appraisers says it supports a focus on why Black homes are devalued. It adds that more education for appraisers and a more diverse workforce could be part of the solution. For NPR News, I'm Jill Sheridan.
Brother, I heard y'all ain't hitting in New York. Word. I heard y'all ain't hitting in L.A. Word. Word. I heard y'all ain't hitting in North Carolina.
North Carolina.
Nicole Hannah-Jones has a Pulitzer Prize and a MacArthur Genius Grant. She also reportedly had the enthusiastic support of the faculty at the University of North Carolina Journalism School. But she will not be receiving a tenured position there at her alma mater. The reason, according to NC Policy Watch, is political pressure that conservative groups put on the very highest levels of university governance. Joe Killian helped report this story for NC Policy Watch and joins us now. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
Explain what the objection is and who it's coming from.
Well, Nicole Hannah-Jones, over the course of her career, has done a terrific amount of reporting about race in America. As part of this, she conceived the 1619 Project, which has been incredibly controversial among conservatives. This has led to some real trepidation among conservatives, including elected Republicans in this state and conservative groups in this state, as to whether she should be a professor at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill.
Your reporting establishes that there was widespread faculty support for her hire, including from the school's chancellor. Is it common to see a university's highest level of management exert so much say in a single professor being hired on a tenure track?
The Board of Trustees has the final approval on approval of tenure. This is not a tenure track position. This is a tenured position. Mm-hmm. It's a night chair. But it is unusual for a candidate to get all the way through the process with this level of support and support of the chancellor, and then to find it not happen in quite this way, which is that the board didn't even vote. And our understanding from talking to members of the board who spoke to us on background is that the conversations were had outside of meetings that indicated to the chancellor and to the administration and to the dean of the school that this tenure would not be approved, and therefore they would need to hire her as a contract employee for 5 years if they wanted to hire her at all.
The Board of Trustees also spoke publicly about their decision today. Here's Chair Richard Stevens.
In his communication to the provost, Trustee Duckett asked questions regarding the tenure candidacy of Nicole Hannah-Jones and suggested more time and postponed the review to consider those questions.
So what he seems to be saying here is that this is a postponement, not an outright denial of tenure. Can you just help us understand what he is saying here?
He is saying that one of the members of the board asked for more time to review her, to vet her, and that before that could happen, before they got more time and postponed this, the dean of the journalism school went ahead and hired her under a 5-year contract, which essentially put an end to the tenure debate. It didn't go any farther at the Board of Trustees level because it didn't need to. Somebody hired under a 5-year contract doesn't need to be approved by the Board of Trustees. That contradicts the account of the dean and of people who are involved in the direct negotiations.
And just in a sentence or two, has Nicole Hannah-Jones herself said anything about this?
She's been very quiet this week on Twitter. She just said to people who have been supporting her that she's watching and she sees all of them and she appreciates it.
Joe Killian is an investigative reporter for NC Policy Watch. Thank you.
Thank you.
Go to the place where danger awaits me. Woo! It's only friend. So stupid minded, I can't help it, baby.
Brian Broom began writing a memoir of his life when that life was at the absolute bottom.
I mean, I started officially writing this book in rehab.
Broom grew up in Northeast Ohio in Steel Country. His book is called Punch Me Up to the Gods, a poetic title for a brutal act. The book begins with his father beating the 10-year-old with his fists. The blows by his father and even his friends were meant to pound manliness into Broome. He later came out as gay. The story starts with his father, who lost his job as a steel worker as the industry declined.
He stayed at home because my father didn't have much education, and he didn't know what to do other than be a steel worker or some other kind of like backbreaking labor. He thought that that's what men were supposed to do to take care of their families, and he had trouble rethinking his role in the household.
I want to linger on that phrase, what men were supposed to do, because it seems that he spends a great deal of his appearances in this book trying to pound into you what he thinks men are supposed to do and supposed to be.
Yeah. I mean, not just men, I think specifically black men. You know, I knew from very young that I was supposed to be tougher than other men. Black men were supposed to be more masculine. The reason I stopped writing when I was a kid was because my cousin told me it was, you know, it was girly. You shouldn't do that. That's not what men do. Feeling deeply anything or curiosity or finding something pretty or all these things were taken away because you just have to continually play this role of being the toughest guy in the room.
And I want to understand what you feel is distinctively black about that, because any number of people listening will be aware that anti-intellectualism or a certain idea of manliness or that kind of cruelty is super common in any group of people, but it feels like something distinctively black to you. Why?
It feels like something distinctively black to me because of the history of racism in America. I think that there's a legacy of what might be termed emasculation with black men, like throughout history. The ability for them to take care of their families being taken away or just being humiliated. Black men have an extra responsibility to prove that we are manly in many ways. And that's usually by dominating something or being emotionless and stoic.
Where was the bottom for you?
Before I went to rehab, there've been a lot of bottoms. First of all, you know, I think any addict will tell you that they've hit bottoms many times. But the last bottom, I woke up next to a dog in somebody's backyard. The story is a little racy, so I'll skip over the racy parts. But I ended up going to a bar. I met someone, and I ended up passing out in some stranger's backyard next to their doghouse. And I woke up the next morning, and there was a big dog panting in my face. And I told that story to a friend of mine, and I told it as a funny story, like, ha ha, guess what happened to me the other night?
Hmm.
And he said, that's not funny. You are a black man. If somebody had looked out the window and saw you in their yard and shot you, nobody would blame them. They would blame you. That's not a funny story. And if you don't go get some help, we're not going to be friends anymore. And that was the impetus for me saying, well, I'll just go to rehab to placate some people. And when I went to rehab, it turned out quite differently. I recognized that I had a problem and that I needed to be there.
I'm thinking about your story and the fact that you said that you were interested in writing as a boy and gave it up because people disapproved of that. And I'm aware that you ended up in a Master of Fine Arts program I guess in your 40s, in your late 40s, which is totally fine, but later than a lot of people end up doing that. And I'm wondering if you feel that the way you were treated in your youth forced you to waste decades of your life.
Absolutely. I have great regret for the amount of time that I've wasted. When I finally went to college, there was that shame of, you're in your late 40s. Like, and I was surrounded by 18-year-olds. Like, any of these people could be your child. I was ashamed of that. But after a while, I just thought, you know, what else are you going to do? I mean, what else can you do? Are you going to go back to something that makes you miserable? Are you just going to do some job for a paycheck and just be miserable and then relapse? You know, what else are you going to do? So I went to community college after rehab, and then I met some really great people who said, you know, you're actually not a bad writer. Maybe you should pursue that. And I just got my MFA. I just graduated.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. From the University of Pittsburgh.
And they were right. You're not a bad writer. It's a beautiful book.
Thank you.
Not to give away the end, but at the very end, you thank your father for the lessons he taught you. Given what we've learned about him, what did he teach you?
I don't think my father, you know, I think people are going to read this book and think that my father is the bad guy. But I don't think he was the bad guy. I believe that my father suffered from depression. I believe that he suffered from anxiety. I believe that he suffered from a low self-image and he couldn't see his way out of it. So he didn't know he was teaching me those things. I certainly didn't know he was teaching me those things at the time. But when I look back, I see that from his behavior, what I don't want to do, that I want to take care of my mental health, that I think Black Americans should look into their mental health, because it's hard living in the United States as a Black person. It's demoralizing some days. This is kind of a love letter to Black boys, to tell them that you don't have to be this thing that the world keeps telling you that you are. You can be anything you want to be. And then, you know, as I was writing, it got broader and broader, and I thought this could really be a prescription for anybody who feels like they have to perform a specific way because of the body that they're living in.
Brian Broom, congratulations on the memoir and on your graduation as well.
Thank you very much.
And the memoir is called Punch Me Up to the Gods. When a police officer is accused of misconduct, it is common for officials to promise an investigation.
I am concerned by the actions of some of our officers.
I will absolutely look at the case in its entirety.
We have opened an internal affairs investigation into this.
So officials say at press conferences, but the public rarely hears anything more. The results of internal affairs investigations are very often confidential. Now we can reveal how some of those secret investigations turned out over the years. California opened its once hidden records, and a new podcast from NPR and KQED examines how police investigate police when they thought nobody would be watching. Suki Lewis of San Francisco's KQED has spent 2.5 years going through thousands of police internal affairs files, documents, videos, much more, and she's with us now. Hey there, Suki.
Hi, Steve.
So I know it's been difficult. Local departments have resisted releasing this public information, but what have you found so far?
Well, it's still really not a complete picture because of that difficulty we've had getting files from all these different policing agencies. But we are starting to see how departments investigate serious use of force by police and that it's often documented but rarely disciplined. We also got to see misconduct cases and these internal investigations that found officers who were disciplined for theft, domestic violence, lying on police reports, and abusing their power to sexually harass or abuse people. Mm. And in many of these serious cases, the officers were fired or they resigned, but weren't criminally investigated or charged. So departments might fire an officer, but by keeping the misconduct out of the criminal justice system, those cases were still secret and protected by officer confidentiality.
Well, how does that confidentiality affect a case?
I'll tell you about this one case. There was this woman named Catherine Jenks, and she kept calling 911 for help when there was no apparent emergency. The officers kept responding, and they thought that maybe something was going on with her mental health. But when she calls 911 again, they arrest her for abusing the emergency system, and then they charge her with resisting arrest. But the body camera footage doesn't match what they wrote on their police reports. I'm going to play some audio from the incident. A warning, it's really hard to listen to and may not be appropriate for kids. Jenks got really badly injured by a police dog during the arrest. The department investigated and found that the officers shouldn't have arrested her in the first place and that they falsified information on their police reports to make their use of force seem justified. But until we reported on this, Catherine Jenks didn't know anything about the internal affairs findings, and she was still facing criminal charges.
Ah, something that her defense lawyers surely would have wanted to know. Are you still learning more about cases like this?
Yes. Just in recent days, we've learned more about the high-profile case of Oscar Grant. He was a young man in Oakland killed on a BART train platform on New Year's Day in 2009.
Right.
There was huge public scrutiny of this case and massive public protests. It was really the first case to go viral due to cell phone footage and sparked the Black Lives Matter movement. But the recordings of the internal affairs investigation weren't released by the agency until KQED actually sued them, and they just came out a couple of weeks ago. So here's a BART detective starting the interview with an officer, Tony Peroni, whose actions on the platform were really in question after the incident.
I'd like to put it on record that I have a close, personal, and working relationship with you, Tony. And I want to make sure that you're okay with me interviewing you.
Yeah, I'm fine with that.
Whoa.
Okay.
So it's stunning that they have this guy who worked really closely with both the officer who shot Oscar Grant, Johannes Meserle, and Tony Peroni run their interrogations. And we heard this over and over, especially in use of force cases. The investigators can be really deferential to the officers rather than pushing back on them or asking them for answers.
Okay, we said 700 California law enforcement agencies, all of whose records in theory have been made public. Do they all have these kinds of secrets?
Going through all the records we've gotten so far, one thing that's really stood out is what a patchwork police discipline is. The agencies or departments, they have different rules, or even if they have the same policies, they enforce them differently. So that means a cop who might be fired or disciplined for something in San Francisco might not even get a reprimand for it somewhere else. And I'll give you one kind of funny example of this. One of the investigations we got was about this officer who got caught stealing. He'd taken a Blue Lives Matter mug from one of his colleagues. There was an interrogation and everything, and he gets fired. The darker side of that uneven enforcement is that in another case that we look at in the podcast, there's an officer who fails to investigate a statutory rape. And while he also gets fired, he immediately gets hired by a new department.
Which is something that confidentiality makes possible, I suppose. What are some of the other things that make it hard to hold officers accountable?
Well, here in California, like a lot of other states, police officers have a very robust Bill of Rights that protects them when they go into these interview rooms. For instance, they have the right to know what they're going to be questioned about ahead of time. They also have rights to an extensive appeals process for any discipline that's imposed. So the way it's set up, the incentives aren't necessarily about justice or even necessarily about protecting the public.
Okay, protecting who then?
Well, one of the people I've talked to a number of times over the past couple of years is Judge Ladoris Cordell. After she retired from the bench in Santa Clara County, she served as a police auditor for the city of San Jose, which means she got to sit in on internal affairs cases.
So you talk about the cities getting at the truth or justice. The cities basically are protecting themselves from lawsuits. They're concerned about liability.
She wasn't the only person who pointed this out to me, that this system that says it's about accountability is actually about managing risk to the city. Now, I don't want to suggest that accountability can't be a part of the process, but because of these special rights and the way that things are set up, cities in some ways are more beholden to these contracts with their employees, with police officers, than they are to members of the public.
Suki, thanks for the reporting.
Thank you.
Picket line, picket sign, punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see.
Sheriff's deputies who fatally shot a Black man, Andrew Brown Jr., last month in Elizabeth City, North Carolina, will not face charges. District Attorney Andrew Womble announced yesterday his conclusion that the officers were justified in their actions.
I find that the facts of this case
clearly illustrate the officers who used deadly force on Andrew Brown Jr. did so reasonably and only when a violent felon used a deadly weapon to place their lives in danger.
We're going to hear now from attorney Wayne Kendall. He is part of the legal team representing Andrew Brown Jr.'s family. Mr. Kendall, thanks for being with us this morning. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
What has been the response from Andrew Brown Jr.'s family to this decision?
Well, of course, they're very disappointed in the fact that the district attorney there in Pasco Tank County decided not to proceed with criminal charges against these deputy sheriff's officers, as we believe they violated the law when they took Andrew Brown Jr.'s life in the manner in which they did.
The DA's office used the opportunity yesterday to show four short edited videos of the shooting during this press conference. I understand you have seen the entire video unedited. What does that show? What in that full version would prove that this was an unjustified shooting?
Well, first of all, I need to correct you there.
Please.
None of us have seen the full videos in their entirety, unredacted. We have seen first a 30-second snippet, then subsequent to a hearing to see all of the videos that was filed by the media and the Sheriff's Department itself, the judge allowed us to see almost 19 minutes, which was redacted. Parts of the faces were redacted, and I think parts of their bodies were redacted. The weapons were redacted. So we have never seen the entirety of the what we now believe to be five body cam videos, as well as one dash cam video.
It would be your preference to be able to view the entire video, but what did even those excerpts show you?
Well, also, the judge did not allow all of the defense team to see the videos. He only allowed one representative who was a North Carolina licensed attorney to view that 19-minute segment of the four or five body cam videos. And what our representative who saw those videos stated to us was that Andrew Brown had his hands visible on the wheel of the vehicle when the videos began, and his hands were clearly visible at all times. The deputy shouted commands to him. He bagged his car up and drove across a vacant lot, which is next door to his home, and they were shooting into the vehicle. According to our representative, the shots started before he ever put the vehicle in reverse to try to flee that particular scene. So there's a discrepancy between what our representatives said he saw and what the district attorney indicated yesterday in his press conference that was on the videos. So we don't know until we see all of the videos in their entirety as to what those videos actually show.
So the district attorney is claiming that Brown was using the vehicle as a weapon, that the officers in question felt threatened. From your understanding of those excerpts, you believe that not to be true, that that Brown was not using the car in an aggressive manner against those officers?
Well, when I viewed the district attorney playback, some of the videos yesterday during his press conference, I didn't know whether to believe what my eyes were seeing or what my ears were hearing. Because what I saw on his video, on his playback of the video, did not fit the description that he was describing to the assembled press at the press conference. He said that the victim, Mr. Brown, was using the vehicle in an offensive manner. And I did not see that. I saw him attempting to escape, and the fact that he was shot in the back of the head indicates that the shots were coming from his rear as he was attempting to leave the scene. And I did not see
Mr. Brown aim that vehicle at any of those deputies that were on the scene at the time?
The DA announced that the officers involved will keep their jobs, though they'll be disciplined and retrained. Question for you, is the family at this point planning to pursue a civil suit?
Yes, all options are on the table. Certainly, a civil suit is one of those options. So that would be one of the things that we would certainly look at. We're also going to be looking at getting transparency and accountability. Yesterday, we filed a petition ourselves. The two previous petitions for the recordings were not filed by the family members. We yesterday filed a petition ourselves, so we expect that to be adjudicated just shortly.
We'll have to leave that there. Thank you. Wayne Kendall, part of the legal team representing the Brown family. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
60 miles away, they had the Tulsa riots years before I was born. But they never talked about them.
Never?
Slaughter. It was a slaughter. They never talked about it. The old folks never talked about it when I was in Oklahoma.
Wow.
I heard a rumor about it. I didn't know what to think.
100 years ago, a white mob descended on a prosperous black business district in Tulsa, Oklahoma. That mob killed hundreds in one of the worst episodes of racial violence in U.S. history. Well, today on Capitol Hill, lawmakers heard from living survivors of the 1921 Tulsa race massacre. NPR's Juana Summers reports.
When the mobs came to Greenwood, Viola Fletcher was just 7 years old.
I still smell smoke and see fire. I still see black businesses being burned. I still hear airplanes flying overhead. I hear the screams. I have lived through the massacre every day. Our country may forget this history, but I cannot.
Fletcher was one of three survivors of that violence to testify before a House panel. Historians say that the massacre left as many as 300 black people dead and more than 10,000 homeless. Once known as Black Wall Street, Greenwood was destroyed. Lessie Benningfield Randall described what it was like to live in Greenwood as a child. Testifying by video conference, she said it was a place where she had no fear.
Then everything changed. It was like a war. White men with guns came and destroyed my community. We couldn't understand why.
Now, as Tulsa prepares to commemorate the 100th anniversary of the massacre, survivors like Fletcher want reparations.
I am 107-year-old and have never been seen justice. I pray that one day I will. I have been blessed with a long life and have seen the best and the worst of this country. I think about the terror, horror inflicted upon black people in this country every day.
Fletcher's younger brother, Hughes Van Ellis, testified too. The World War II veteran wore a U.S. Army ball cap, and he described the multiple unsuccessful attempts by survivors and their relatives to seek justice through the courts.
We were shown that in the United States, not all men were equal under law. We were shown that when blacks' voices called out for justice, no one cared.
Ellis, who's 100, called for the last survivors of the Tulsa race massacre to be acknowledged while they're still living.
Please do not let me leave this earth without justice, like all the others, massacre survivors. Thank you so much.
Each survivor's testimony was met with a standing ovation. When Ellis finished, he was asked if there was anything else he would like to say. He thanked the committee for listening to him and said he hoped they would be able to work together. Then he lifted one finger in the air and said,
"We are one. We are one."
Lessie Benningfield Randall says she has survived 100 years of painful memories and a fight for justice that is long overdue.
I am here today, 106 years old, looking at you all in the eye. We've waited 100 years. No, we have waited too long, and I am tired. We are tired.
Juana Summers, NPR News.
But who are they to judge us simply 'cause our hair is long?
In the early hours of June 1, 1921, a siren or whistle sounded in Tulsa just after 5 a.m., and the white mob and local law enforcement that then moved into the Greenwood community was armed with weapons, guns, and cameras. As a result, University of Oklahoma Regents professor Carlos Hill says that the Tulsa race massacre is the best documented episode of racial violence in the early part of the 20th century. Some of those images have become infamous and are familiar. Yet still others are still revelatory, now nearly 100 years later. Professor Hill has assembled a new book that shows this documentation of the destruction, the loss of life, the wholesale internment of the city's black population, and the evident pride of the city's white community that, in the ironic vernacular of the time, quote, put down a Negro uprising, unquote. But the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre, A Photographic History, also documents the resiliency of Tulsa's Greenwood community. With the words of survivors juxtaposed throughout, you see how this community moved from survivor to refugee to rebuilder to thriver as the community came back, despite obstacles to rebuilding and no compensance for their losses. Carlos Hill is the Regents Professor at the University of Oklahoma and the chair of the Clara Luper Department of African and African American Studies. He's the author of three books, Beyond the Rope, The Impact of Lynching on Black Culture, and Memory, The Murder of Emmett Till, A Graphic History, and now his latest book, The 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre, A Photographic History. Professor Hill, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
In publishing this photographic history, you write that unlike other episodes of racial violence that occurred about the same time, they were the so-called race riots, unquote, after the end of World War I, Tulsa was one of the most photographed incidents. And you asked the question, why? And I would ask you the question, why do you suppose that was?
The race massacre, the 1921 Tulsa race massacre, was the deadliest attack on a black community in American history. And I would even maybe go as far as saying any community in American history. The Greenwood District, circa 1921, was a 35 to 40 block area that was teeming with people and businesses. We, you know, based on census records, there were, you know, over 10,000, nearly 11,000 black residents of the Greenwood District. There were nearly 200 black owned businesses, and the majority of the land in Greenwood was owned by black people, which was a stark contrast to the daily realities of most other black people in this country. And so Greenwood, Black Wall Street, was a symbol of black excellence, and it remains a symbol of black excellence. And so the mob that attacked the Greenwood District numbered in the hundreds and perhaps even in the thousands. And so those individuals, those invaders, as survivors called them, came into the community in the hundreds, some armed with weapons. Many came also with cameras and took photographs of the destruction and the loss of life. And so when I talk about the race massacre, I try to be very clear to people that what occurred in Greenwood, or what happened on May 31st and June 1st, the destruction of this exemplary black community, not just an affluent black community, but this exemplary black community, the destruction of that community was not exceptional. This occurred. Mobs attacked black communities and had attacked black communities for decades before the race massacre. Black people were driven from communities, you know, across this country for decades before the race massacre. And so what occurred in Tulsa, what occurred and what happened to that community is not exceptional. But what is unprecedented about what occurred is its scope, right? A 35 block area, one of the wealthiest black communities in this country, in a matter of 18 hours, completely destroyed. And not only was it completely destroyed, whites who participated in that destruction documented it with photographs. Whites who took photographs of the violence were careful not to take pictures of whites who were looting Greenwood or actually lighting fire to buildings or even dropping bombs, incendiaries on the community. But what they did document was the destruction, the physical destruction of Greenwood. They documented some of the black victims of that violence. They documented the detention. They documented the ways in which, to a certain degree, Greenwood in circa 1921-22 rebuilt itself. And so what we know from about the massacre photographically comes from whites, and I would say whites who entered into the community on June 1st. Some of them were armed. Some of them came armed and perhaps with cameras to document not just what occurred, but the suppression of a quote-unquote Negro rebellion. And so at the time, this was white documenting racial violence, such as lynchings, was common. So for Tulsans to go into Greenwood with cameras and begin to take pictures of what occurred was not abnormal. It was a part of lynching culture. And so when we think about the race massacre, we cannot exceptionalize it. We need to understand it as a part of American culture, right? We need to understand it as a part of lynching culture. But what makes the race massacre so important is the scope and the scale of what occurred. A community the size of Greenwood, you know, the affluence of Greenwood, a community that size was destroyed in less than 18 hours. That is unprecedented. And that's what we need to really be thinking about as we near the centennial.
In the course of the book, there are a number of pictures that have been seen over and over again, but what you see in this book is so many pictures, some very familiar, others not so familiar, that again points out that scope. Certainly there are pictures of the devastation. There are pictures that show a street level. There are also pictures from hills from different vantage points of the community, and you get the sense of the scope of the devastation. I mean, the only thing I can compare it to is the aftermath of a total warfare battle in what would be World War I or World War II. This community was utterly destroyed.
The community was annihilated. You know, everyone in the Greenwood District was impacted by this. If you had 10,000 plus black residents living and working in the Greenwood District, you know, at the time of the massacre, those same 10,000 plus individuals were rendered homeless on June 1. And so everyone, every black person in the community was impacted. And when you look at the photographs that whites took to document and to tell the story of the suppression of this quote unquote Negro rebellion, you know, we have to be careful to situate this. I would say that if you just look at the photographs without any context, yes, it looks like photographs of Berlin that had, you know, been bombed by the Allied forces during World War II, or perhaps even Paris. But it's an American community, and it's a black community, one of the wealthiest black communities of its time. When we think about the massacre, what I've tried to be clear about and why I talk about it as a massacre is it was a systematic military-style assault on a civilian community that was aided and abetted by local authorities and a white mob. And so this invasion of the community that began in earnest at 5 a.m. on June 1st, this invasion, there was resistance, black resistance, collective armed resistance to this invasion, because black Greenwood residents who had worked and toiled and built this magnificent community wasn't going to let it be destroyed without a fight. And so it's very important for us to say that Greenwood, black Greenwood, was not at war with or in rebellion against white Tulsans. They were simply in defense of their community that they had in a decade's time, or let's say 15 years' time, built into one of the most affluent black communities, period, in the country. And so, you know, I've heard people say, having looked at the photographs, this was a race war. It was not. This was a white community that had been a white mob that had been weaponized by the local authorities to attack a community, and the black community in their self-defense tried to prevent it. And so this is not a war, but what we did see occurring was a community that represents the tradition of collective armed self-defense. And this is something that I'm intimately aware of because I've studied it across the lynching era, how black communities would arm themselves to try to prevent a lynching or an act of racial violence. And so what Greenwood residents did, and certainly black men who went downtown to try to protect Dick Rowland from a lynch mob, they were brought there not just out of concern for Dick Rowland. They came downtown because of the tradition of collective armed self-defense. Because, you know, black people, black Americans, and I know black Tulsans understood that the best way to stop a lynching was not to try to moralize and write editorials after the fact, but the best way to stop a lynching was to actually stop a lynching, to put one's body between the threatened lynch victim and the mob.
My guest today is Carlos Hill. He's the Regents Professor at the University of Oklahoma. He's the chair of the Clara Luper Department of African and African American Studies. And he's the author of a new book titled The 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre, a Photographic History, which assembles several hundred photographs of the massacre, the immediate aftermath, the interment, the long process of rebuilding in the community. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, again, another question you ask in the introduction is the psychological perspectives of white Tulsans and what becomes clear. And again, as you mentioned, you have to see these pictures with the context, oftentimes with just the captions that were placed on some of these photographs, which were turned into postcards as a way to, I don't want to say celebrate, but at least acknowledge white superiority at the time. That psychological perspective becomes pretty clear. And you see some really amazing images that some I'd never seen before. You mentioned there were very few pictures of white people actually committing acts of violence and looting, but there are some pictures that inadvertently capture that. There's one picture that's really, it really made an impression on me. You see two armed men walking away from the fires. You see the fires in the background in the Greenwood District, while a whole another set of onlookers, which would include women and people like looking like they're going to a picnic, are heading into the Greenwood District to gawk and onlook. To me, that is a really telling photograph.
It's telling because, you know, in many ways, what I always say to people about photography of racial violence is these images are not created for us, you know, for a 21st century audience. They're created for an audience who assume and actually believe that white people are superior to black people, that black people are inferior. Not only are they inferior, they are a criminal class and are intellectually, you know, socially, culturally inferior. So inferior in all ways. And so the ease with which whites would take pictures of deceased black bodies or destroyed black community wouldn't have been something for whites that was controversial. But today, of course, it is controversial, and it should have been controversial in 1921, but it wasn't because of the deep and unabiding belief in white supremacy and black inferiority. And so you can't understand those photographs with understanding just that basic context that it was not controversial to kill black people in public vis-a-vis lynching. It was not controversial to destroy a black community because the rationale always revolved around, you know, black inferiority and white superiority. And so, you know, the casualness with which whites are walking through the community, you know, and taking pictures alongside the destruction and deceased black bodies all fits within lynching culture and the ways in which in 1921 and well into the latter part of the 20th century, white supremacy was assumed. And for whites, it was an article of faith. And so you can't understand those photographs and the ways in which white people position themselves in that photo, in those photographs, without understanding that context, because none of the individuals that appear in those photographs are shamed. None of them are attempting to hide, you know, their likeness. They actually want to be seen, and they want their friends, family, and relatives to see their participation in this. And so this is, I think, a different culture. It's lynching culture, and I know lynching culture survives in many ways that we are unconscious of, or most people are unconscious of, but this is why whites position themselves in the photographs in the ways that you mentioned.
As devastating as that first section of the book is, perhaps even more upsetting is the next section of the book, which is the internment, where you really see that attitude at play. At this point, people are disarmed, and unfortunately it brings up notions of other internments that have happened throughout history that we also can see photographs where the perpetrators are not ashamed at all. They're looking on, they're catcalling and looking on in pride as this community is interred and degraded after the fact.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I have studied, you know, similar outbreaks of anti-black violence where black people are violent, their communities are violently attacked, and they are forced to flee, in many cases, those communities, those families never returned to the community in which they were expelled. And so with Tulsa, the community, not only did they rebuild, but the community experienced a renaissance just 20 years after the race massacre. And so it's very important for us to understand both the depth of the destruction, but also the depth of the resilience of survivors and how they rebuilt Black Wall Street, and not just rebuilt it, but it was even bigger and better. When I say bigger and better, I mean there were more Black people in Greenwood 20 years later. There were more businesses in Greenwood 20 years later. And so, you know, you could say from, they say, 1940 to 1960, Greenwood experiences not just a rebirth, but a renaissance. And so, you know, think about that. So what Black survivors suffered, think about what they did, you know, in a short period of time, rebuild. But think about that in the context of what you just laid out, the detention, where after their homes have been destroyed, after their loved ones have been killed, they are now arrested. You know, what happens in Greenwood is not a detention. It's a mass arrest of every Black person that's still there. Man, woman, child are taken to three detention centers, as they were called, initially at the convention hall, but ultimately at the state fairgrounds or McNulty Park. But there were many Black people who had tried to flee but wasn't able to get out, but had found a way to, you know, be given safe haven by a church or given safe haven by a white employer. And so there were just Black people scattered about, right, who were just trying to survive the violence across Tulsa. But for those who were not fortunate enough or those who weren't able to find a safe haven or get out of the community, they were all arrested, men, women, and children, and taken to one of those three, quote-unquote, detention centers. This is where the photographs become really important for me, because they don't just document what occurred. They also carry narratives, or they attempt to carry a narrative. And so the narrative around the detention photographs that whites at the time wanted to perpetuate was that they had suppressed the Negro Rebellion, and now for the protection of Black Tulsans or Black survivors, they would be interned. But at the same time, you know, there are photographs that try to present what is occurring as protection. And then there are other photographs that on the photograph, there are captions that are left that say, captured Negroes en route to. And so therein lies sort of that, those photographs were meant to tell us, right, that this wasn't a riot, but in fact, this was a coordinated, systematic, deliberate attempt to destroy a community and then arrest them. And so the photograph to me that just sort of, I think about it, I meditate about it a lot, because it's so disturbing, but it's also so illustrative of what actually occurred. On page 59 of my book, there's a photograph. And the caption of that photograph, or what's scribbled on that photograph, is "Running the Negro Out of Tulsa." Mm. And it's a photograph that shows or depicts Black residents from afar looking on as Greenwood burned in the background. And so whoever created this photograph certainly had in mind not just destroying the community, but in fact expelling Black people, not just from the Greenwood District, but from Tulsa. And so when we think about the massacre, we always need to not just focus on the destruction to the community or the loss of life. We need to also keep in focus that this was an attempted community lynching. This was a attempted community expulsion. And so the viciousness of what actually occurred, we can only capture it when we think about not just what actually happened, the community rebuilt itself, but what was intended to happen. And when we understand that, we understand the true viciousness and the horror that this history actually represents.
Carlos Hill is a Regents Professor at the University of Oklahoma, where he's chair of the Claire Looper Department of African and African American Studies. He's also a member of the Tulsa Race Massacre Centennial Commission. His new book is titled The 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre, A Photographic History. It's published by OU Press.
But the creative force in the universe gave us brains to analyze what's going on in the environment. See, if we respect ourselves, then we will use our brains to analyze what is going on. And that's why we as black people, we keep raising the question, hey, what's happening? What's happening? What's happening? Everybody you meet, hey, what's happening? What's happening? Because we don't understand what's going on. And the television and people who classify themselves as white are not going to tell us what is going on.
Say, man, I just don't understand what's going on across this land. Oh, what's happening, brother? Hey, what's happening? What's happening, my man?
NPR is celebrating 50 years on the air, so we're looking back to our birth year, 1971. On this day, 50 years ago, Marvin Gaye released an album still considered a masterpiece, What's Going On. The record was a complete departure for the Motown star. Up to that point, Gaye was known for R&B pop hits like Heard It Through the Grapevine and Ain't No Mountain High Enough with Tammy Terrell.
Listen, baby, ain't no mountain high, ain't no valley low, ain't no river wide.
Tammy Terrell's death in 1970 devastated Marvin Gaye. With the battle for civil rights going on at the time and anti-Vietnam War protests, he decided to turn his focus to songs that addressed real-world anger and fear. He was motivated in part by what he learned from his younger brother, who served in Vietnam. The album includes the title track, What's Going On, Mercy, Mercy Me, and Inner City Blues. We're going to hear now from three people who were deeply inspired by these songs. And we start with Kimo Williams, a Black Vietnam veteran and composer.
One of my favorite albums was by Chicago Transit Authority. I love Grand Funk Railroad, The Supremes, really love The Temptations. And then suddenly, What's Going On by Marvin Gaye. It had this kind of smooth flow to it. And for the first time, I connected to the lyrical content.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying.
I think it's genius at how he's able to talk to all of us through the verses of Mother, Mother, Father, Father, and then Brother, Brother.
Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying.
That song is about a Vietnam veteran who's wondering what's going on now that he's back from Vietnam. So that one speaks to me very, very closely because that's the same question I was asking.
What's going on?
What's going on with the hippies? What's going on with the music? What's going on with the protests? Where do I fit in? What is it that I should do? Where should I go? You're asking these questions. And how can it be that we're still asking that question?
I think the plight and the history of Africans in this country is one of brutality. So when Gaye sings about don't punish me with brutality, that hits you in 1971 and it hits you in 2021.
Don't punish me with brutality.
I'm Eva Jefferson Patterson. I'm a civil rights lawyer in Oakland, California.
What's going on? What's going on? What's going on? Yeah, what's going on?
The lyrics speak of American failure, of American oppression, of the fact that America still mistreats many of its citizens.
My name is Michael Cermak. I am a PhD in environmental sociology from Boston College. The song Mercy, Mercy Me sort of stood out to me. Oil wasted on the ocean and upon our seas, fish full of mercury.
Oil wasted on the oceans and upon our seas, fish full of mercury.
That one really hit me because I was an environmental science scholar studying the world's oceans, literally, and studying the creatures in the oceans, and starting to learn that same bad news all over again. In the late 2000s, I found myself doing outreach education with high schoolers and teaching this environmental science using standardized textbooks, and realizing that I wasn't really engaging the students, right? Seeing a kind of a wall of blank faces. But of course, when we could talk about Marvin Gaye, several of them knew who he was. And so that was a great bridge to how we could teach in a more diverse manner about environmental issues.
The other song that actually guts me is the song, and I feel like I'm going to choke up now talking about it, but it's the song Inner City Blues. And there's that lyric, makes me want to holler, throw up both my hands.
Oh, make me want to holler the way they do my life. Make me want to holler the way they do my life.
He just goes through a litany of all the terrible things that have happened and are continuing to happen to Black people and other people. Latinos, Asian Americans are catching hell now, progressive people, trans people, makes me want to holler, throw up both my hands. And you just wonder why these injustices go on and on and on.
Bills pile up, sky high, send that boy off to die. Oh, make me wanna holler the way they do my life. Yeah, make me wanna holler the way they do my life.
So we thank you, Marvin Gaye. I love this song. I'll play it until I die. And maybe someday I'll come back and say, you know, things are better.
That was Eva Jefferson Patterson, a civil rights lawyer who co-founded the Equal Justice Society and also sings in a Motown cover band in Oakland, California. Michael Cermak, an environmental sociologist who co-owns Green Dragons, a health and wellness program for youth in the Boston area. And Kimo Williams, a Vietnam veteran and composer who recently created a video memorial to the more than 58,000 Americans who died during that war. They were paying tribute to Marvin Gaye's classic album, What's Going On, released 50 years ago today.
Context of white supremacy. Marvin Gaye. Today's date, Saturday, May 22, 2021, so I have been told. Our compensatory call-in each week, we review what's going on. At least for the past 7 days, generally it is white supremacy racism. Locally, nationally, globally. If you have commentary to share, the number 720-716-7300, the code 564-943 pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 720-716-7300, the code 564-943 pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Things to say, if we will get to the callers. Before we began broadcasting today, I went briefly to the grocery store. I was going by the University of Washington campus on the way. They had flyers up posting the 20-year anniversary of Rainy Dog Radio, which is the University of Washington's campus radio station here at Seattle, Washington. And I was perplexed for a number of reasons, but for people, if you've been listening or closely paying attention for a long time, the Cows started at Rainy Dog Radio October 2007. We were thrown off the air within 2 months because of talking about Vietnam. The white fellow who wrote the screenplay for Planet of the Apes and said he based it on his experience in Vietnam. And he talked about, I specifically got in trouble because we quoted him. He said that he missed killing gooks and slopes. How much fun it was killing non-white people in Vietnam. The masters of anti-Asian violence. They passed the anti-Asian hate crime bill this week. Couldn't play everything, but that was important. That did happen this week. But the masters of anti-Asian violence are classified as white. Anyway, but we got in trouble for that. But I was thinking, like, dang, are we supposed to be a part of the anniversary? Should Back of the Bus and I come and say a word or two? They didn't have the Cows on the flyer about the 20-year anniversary, but I mean, we are a part of the Rainy Dog history here at the University of Washington. I'm sure in the back of the corner, dustbin, trash heap. Tim Wise, like, we weren't even there just clowning, being goofy. We played some Marvin Gaye while we were there, but we had, like, Timothy Wise on the program and the Black Student Union when they were having the bachelor's auction selling off Negro males. Woo! Rainy Dog days, context of white supremacy. We had an ungodly time slot. We had a 8 a.m. time slot, so we had to be, anyway. The go back, things ain't what they used to be. I don't remember things being that well at any point under the system. Anyway, so they're doing their 20-year anniversary. Marvin Gaye, 50 years, a half century since the release of What's Going On, 1971. Stunning. A tad depressing that that album would still be so relevant in so many ways here in 2021. But I mean, hey, all I can say, I was not born at the time that this album was released. But wow, this is one album I have heard through and through many, many times, many of the different variations of it, the live version, which is amazing to hear Marvin Gaye with a live Black Washington D.C. audience doing the What's Going On album where they, like, know all the words. Ridiculous. But 50 years since the release, it is a little bit disappointing. But I mean, that's how you are relevant. And it reminded me so much because they talked about Marvin Gaye. When I've sent on the Cows for years, body of work. Marvin Gaye has an extraordinary body of work. The material he did with Tammy Terrell and After the Dance and the Trouble Man soundtrack. I mean, Marvin Gaye's body of work is immense, behemoth. All of that said, I have never heard anyone say that they think he did a better album than What's Going On. Never. If people saw the film One Night in Miami with Marvin Gaye, Sam Cooke, it's not a documentary, but the dramatization, Jim Brown and Minister Malcolm X being together after Cassius Clay at the time wins the heavyweight championship. The main point of the film, Minister Malcolm talking to all of them and the audience, perhaps, and to Sam Cooke specifically at many points in the film, what is your life supposed to be about? Are you just supposed to sit up here and sing songs, goofy songs, silly songs, entertain us? Is that what you're supposed to do with your talents as a Black person in a system of white supremacy? What are we supposed to, what is going on? What should I be doing once I figure out what is going on? I said, that's the main point of that. What is my life supposed to be about? If I'm classified as black in a system of white supremacy, what is my life supposed to be about? That What's Going On album, it will make you contemplate, what is my life supposed to be about? What is going on? What should I be doing about what's going on? Like, oh, extraordinary. As they said, masterpiece. Best work I've heard Mr. Fuller say it and others. It's not a coincidence. We are generally at our best in applying our talents, skills, however immense they are, when we are addressing the problem that is squarely in front of us, all non-white people in the known universe. How are we going to replace white supremacy with justice? That's everything. Talking about his brother in Vietnam, that is white supremacy, racism, again, the kings of anti-Asian violence. And the timing, where Reed Geronimo Pratt, two tours in Vietnam, I kept saying, send that boy off to die. They didn't even reference. I was able to weave it in when we heard the segment, the love, get the full love letter to black boys, the book written by Brian Broom, Black Male, when he was talking about his substance abuse problems. I think maybe the most important song on that album, Flying High in the Friendly Sky, they didn't even mention that one, where he's talking about his heroin addiction, which was a big part of racism, white supremacy at the time this album was released. Like, what a timestamp, time capsule, if you will, of what was happening with racism, white supremacy at this particular point in time. What is going on? Vietnam, heroin, that era of narcotics and racist poisoning, not quite in the crack era yet, and opioids and all the rest of it, dog food, but we're at the heroin point in time. I'm getting lots of black people, former Black Panther members and all, getting them, as he said, hooked on the boy who makes slaves out of men. Marvin Gaye. Marvin Gaye. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. As I said, I was not alive when this album was released, but things are timeless, particularly connected to racism, white supremacy. That can be totally irrelevant if we are fortunate to have any folks who were alive at the time that that album was released and have any recollections that might be cool to share. Let's see. Other things from what we heard. Let's see. Paul Mooney passing away at the age of 79. Lots of loss and grieving this year. Victim of white supremacy. Incidentally, I guess what they call being totally transparent. I did invite Mr. Mooney as a guest on the program. He has twin sons, and I spoke with one of them and trying to see if we could get him on the program. And I gave them information about who we were and sent the link. This was like circa 2009. This is way, 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 way back. Circa 2009, maybe 2010. So I sent them, you know, information and told them what we talk about, racism, white supremacy, blah, blah, blah. And his son got back to me. He's like, I don't know. He wasn't cows. He was not excited about talking to you at all, Brother Gus. Like, dang, really? Oh, well. Despised for a dozen years. But sad to see that he passed away, 79 years. I did see they resurface. They do this regularly. They don't do this with other non-white people. They had lots of the allegations that he did some sort of sexual abuse, sexual molestation of one of Richard Pryor's offsprings. He was never charged for that. No investigation, but I did see that that was talked about quite a bit as well. System of racism, white supremacy. But Mr. Mooney passing away, who did do a lot of talking also about racism, white supremacy, in much of his stand-up material, Chappelle's show, as they mentioned, and Richard Pryor's show and stand-up material, long career. And I thought it was so important in that NPR segment. Now, they just said, they played in the audio clip preceding when the NPR white people got to talking, they said the godfather of comedy. They couldn't say that in NPR. Like, no, 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 no. We've got to nigger this up. The godfather of black comedy. Whoa, that's not what they said. That's not what they said with all of his influence and all this. How many white people can say that they have a career better than Paul Mooney's in terms of writing? Stand up, writing for other people, participation in television programs over that long a period of time. How many white people can say that? No. Can't be just, yes, godfather of, no. Godfather of Negro comedy. Yes. Racism, why, even in death, victim of white supremacy, Paul Mooney. And at 79, in my view, I still think that's kind of young. We should not be checking out at 79. That's absurd. Let's see. Next, the speaking of absurd, and we should not be leaving here at 79, some of the culprits for that, white culprits, the American Medical Association. Man, missed having Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, third generation physician, with us for this one. She talked about her views and how the American Medical Association practiced racism, white supremacy in a myriad of ways. And she, as the only physician talking about this, psychiatrist talking about the issue of racism, white supremacy, and how that caused so much trouble for her in her career. I would love to have heard her thoughts when she got a chance to read the report. And even in the archive, she talked about that right here at the Cows. Let's see. Speaking of folks who despise the context of white supremacy, Nicole Hannah-Jones, I've just been talking about her regular, cowbell. Nicole Hannah-Jones with a white parent. Still a victim of white supremacy, but they talked about her being denied tenure at the University of North Carolina, and they listed her numerous accolades, overqualified, and I don't know, said they got political pressure. I don't know if we need to give this nigger tenure. Like, really? That's so embarrassing. Like, to have that many credentials and folks sit around and conspire and unjust networking to keep you from getting this job. We'll just hire you for another 5 years on a temporary basis and see how it goes from there. Give you a little bit more seasoning. I guess I could do the same thing. Full disclosure, I invited many, many years back, not quite 2009, but it was not recent. I invited Nicole Hannah-Jones to speak with us. I believe it was about the Michael Brown Jr. report that she authored about the racism in the school system in Missouri. She also must be joking. I've got a Pulitzer Prize, MacArthur Genius Grant. Be bothered speaking with you Negroes, or you specifically, Gus T. Despised for a dozen years. Victim of white supremacy. But yes, denied tenure, that happens so frequently, and they come up with all kinds of reasoning. You dress too shabby, you dress too sharp, your views are too controversial, you talk too much about racism, you spend too much time listening to the Cows. They come up with any reason. No, we can't give you tenure. Nah. The Love Letter to Black Boys, again, this is authored by Brian Bloom, victim of white supremacy. Sobriety would be best. That number one. And then I just thought it was interesting. Anytime, really, when these white people conducting the interview speak with a black person, as they were wrapping up that interview, and he said, wow, you thank your father at the end of this. I was like, whoa, that was so shocking. And then he had to explain, like, yeah, the Broom, and explaining, saying, yeah, I guess many people would read this and think, no, my dad is kind of a villain. And of course, Negro villains are. They're responsible for the destruction and evil of everything. And he says, you know, I just want to thank my dad. I think he was a victim of depression. Victim of white supremacy. Absolutely, in every way. Who taught him to be a quality parent and to rear offspring? Who taught any of us that? Absolutely. But I appreciate that. Somebody having some sympathy for a black person, especially a black male. That is rare in these parts. Let's see. I'm very interested in checking out the book on the 1921 Tulsa incident of white terrorism. We have a black author who's saying that this is not race war. Words are so important. This is a purge. This is white terrorism. It is the beginning of knowledge to call things by their proper name. We are not at war right now. We were not at war in 1921. If you're taking a defensive posture against an overwhelming and superior force, that is not race war. They bragged. He said, and even that was another one. The white person doing the interview, he said, I don't want to say that some of these pictures, it looks like they're celebrating. Yes. Why we got a pussyfoot and tiptoe now? Yes, celebrating, bragging about mistreating the Negroes, purging the Negro, running the Negroes out of Tulsa, as they said. Yes, that is standard operating procedure. Also a core component of lynching culture, white supremacy culture, one and the same. Having difficulty, and we got all that stuttering and stammering about acknowledging, yes, white people brag all the time. That's why we got all these racist jokes, even 2021, about mistreating black people. Yes, it's not anything to feel bad about. Incidentally, before I get to the metaphors, man, I had to include Dr. Welsing talking about why our brain computer compels us regularly to ask, what's happening? What's going on? Why is that such a staple of culture, especially in the U.S. amongst black people? She said it so many times, like literally, I was like, you need to wrap up the cows and quit if you cannot find the segment, especially for Marvin Gaye, 50-year anniversary of Marvin Gaye, what's going on? And as many times as Dr. Welsing said and explained, gave her counter-racist analysis of what's happening. And if you're too lazy or ignorant or whatever to find it, like, you should just quit right now, Gus T. I pulled up my Welsing files, her 31 visits, which is hours. I said, wow, I hope this doesn't take too long. I kid you not. I said, we'll go with visit number 20 and see what we get. I had to listen for 2 minutes and bing, what's happening? Thank you. I was really going to be upset, though, if I could not have located it, like, because I felt that was so important. Again, so right. Another one I would appreciate hearing Dr. Welsing's commentary on. But Francis Cress Welsing, third generation physician, MD, Marvin Gaye at his best. What's going on? What's happening? Anyway, for the metaphors, we heard a great one in the audio segment when I'm speaking of the American Medical Association. So they were talking about the report and they said the same thing. We're not going to do all that pussyfooting and sit here and talk about privilege and prejudice and discrimination and all the rest of it. Call things by their proper name. We're not going to tiptoe around things. I love it. Metaphor right there. We're going to be direct and call things by their proper name. Metaphors, so important. There was another one. I had a person write in a metaphor to me this week, see if I can remember it. And this person made an error. We all make errors, but this person made an error while they were making an accusation against another black person, which is wretched. Like, if we're going out to accuse another black person of something, we should all, like, triple, quadruple check our information and make sure we're not recklessly accusing black people. We got lots and lots and lots and lots of that already. Anyway, so this person was in error. And so in acknowledging their error, they said, oh, man, I guess I did make some errors and I left myself open for a few jabs. And they said that's a metaphor. They even pointed it out, which I appreciate, that some Cows listeners are more mindful about the metaphors that they use. And when others employ metaphors, analogies, figures of speech around them. Bravo. Very important. Useful skill, in my opinion. But the person acknowledged, like, yeah, that is a metaphor to say that I left myself open for a few jabs. And I said, now, this person writing this commentary is, you know, purportedly a non-white female, black female. And I said, Gusty, despised for a dozen years, frequently accused of hating black females. That's the metaphor that I get where you are acknowledging that you made an error. But even that is, I left myself open for jabs from Gusty. So even figuratively, Gusty is jabbing away at black females. The metaphors regularly support white supremacy, racism, anti-blackness, black misandry. Many reasons for this broadcast, the compensatory call-in specifically, I request no metaphors. Just be specific about what it is that you're trying to say. I think even sometimes we use these metaphors and we're not even quite sure what the metaphor means. In fact, I know that happens. In fact, give you a double. Yesterday, or 2 days, we were in the book club. Johnny Cochran, Geronimo Jijaga Pratt. They were talking about Johnny Cochran and saying that white people were still upset with him about O.J. Simpson to this day, 2021, still upset with him about that. And they said, man, they might be so upset with him that they'll take it out on him, on us in this case, Geronimo Pratt, which is after, years after O.J. Simpson, unfortunately, continued through that. And so he said, it might be a racist judge on the stand. That's how it said in the book, racist judge on the stand who might say, that old Johnny Cochran, no good Negro, he got off that murdering O.J. I'll fix his ass. It's that metaphor right there, because I've heard that before as well. That's another one, like, wow, in a system where there is so much sexual misconduct, raping of children, all these allegations on a regular basis, sodomizing particularly black males in prison and what have you, rethinking Rufus, delectable Negro and all that. For that, I'll fix his ass. The homoeroticism abounds. Anywho, no metaphors. If we could be precise, exact about what it is that we want to say, that would be appreciated. I will prompt about the metaphors. Again, sometimes we're still learning, so we don't have logic to articulate our views, and we'll swap in an analogy or comparison. Often that just contributes to confusion. Much obliged. Be mindful. Let's see, if you could take about 5 minutes to share your thoughts, observations, suggestions, that would be great. Make sure everyone has at least one chance to share. If you know you are in a noisy environment, if you could use your mute button, that would be greatly appreciated, just so we don't have to compete with a lot of unnecessary background noise, people talking, or if you're watching, you know, the games or whatever in the background. Find a quieter area, then you can join us to share your observations or thoughts. Much obliged. Number again, 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Before we get to the callers, again, Dr. Ruby Lathan, she was supposed to be with us this past week on Wednesday, talk about the importance of diet. Food, something she is so passionate about. I guess Gus T is passionate about too. Has never really thought about myself in that way, but I guess so. But unfortunately, her father passed away suddenly on Wednesday, and so she was not able to be with us. I know many, many Cows listeners over the years, because Dr. Ruby's been so gracious with her time and hung out with us so frequently. Many listeners have greatly benefited from her information about food, and they have incorporated some of the things that she has shared with us into their eating habits, and checked out her website, rubylathan.com. So I am sure many listeners very saddened. One, that we missed out on her, but I mean, most importantly, like, man, that she, her mom, her siblings, she has sisters and brothers, just hope that they are all taking really good care of themselves, nourishing themselves. I hope eating some spectacular food, like all of their dad's favorite recipes. I hope they are enjoying them and coming up and just sharing the best memories of their father. But man, that is same thing that I said this past Wednesday. It's not just, you know, so we can get on here and brag. Ooh, I ate all this kale this week. I ate all the chickpeas. That is not it at all. It is so I said, hey, Paul Mooney passing away at 79, in my view, is a disgrace. If it was not the system of racism, white supremacy, I suspect he would still be here working on TV shows, telling jokes, whatever. You know, Chappelle show reunion. That's the way that we should be thinking, like robust, healthy life, full of vitality. That's what we would have if it wasn't for the system of white supremacy, racism. We're trying as best we can to compensate. This system is trying to steal our lives, steal people that we care about, so they are not here as long as they should be and don't have the quality of life. Got to be taking all kinds of medication and can't get around and feel terrible and have terrible motion, movement, or immobile in some way. Like, forget all of that. That, I think, is what motivates Dr. Ruby Lathan, so that we can be here with the vitality to replace white supremacy with justice, and we can be here healthy, not just here and struggling, but I mean here and feeling good here. And then you can share some of that with your attempted family members, care mates, whatever it is, offspring. Share that information with them as well, especially your offspring, because I mean, wow, those are the folks that you will have the most lifelong impact on in terms of their eating habits, your offspring. So make extremely well thought out logical choices about food if you are an attempted parent. No Cheetos allowed. No sodas allowed. That's the way it should be. Like, really modeling excellent eating habits if you are an attempted mommy, attempted daddy. All of that said, number again, 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Let's see. First few folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary to share, lines should be open. Proceed.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Thank you guys for taking my call. Hello, everyone on the line. I want to say rest in peace and thank you to Paul Mooney. I myself saw one of his stand-up specials, and that helped me understand that what I was seeing was, you know, I wasn't alone in what I was seeing about what's going on with the world around us. So, I just want to say that. Thank you for taking my call. I'll mute my line.
Most of his stand-up comedy career, I believe, whether he was behind the camera, in front of the camera, I believe he talked pretty directly about racism, white supremacy. Lots of folks, I think, have mentioned that he kind of helped them get a grip. What's going on? Again, come back to that for the theme. I think a lot of folks said that over the years. Much obliged, sir. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary to share, lines should be open.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, retired firefighter in Florida.
Best album ever, in my opinion. Best album ever. The album cover had all of the lyrics to all of those songs that you're talking about. I was alive. I was 14 years old at the time when that album came out. Mr. Gay, as was stated, was in a state of depression from losing a close friend of his, Tammy Terrell, and kind of like went on a respite on writing songs and putting out songs, and then comes this album in 1971. Still listen to it today. Lee Evans. Mr. Lee Evans was one of the co-founders of the organization that Dr. Harry Edwards represented called the Project for Human Rights. Most people only understand it from the standpoint of the famous symbolic gesture that Mr. Tommy Smith and Mr. John Carlos performed in the 1968 Mexico Olympic Games. But Mr. Lee Evans also was a world-class sprinter. He participated in two world records in the 400-meter dash and also the 1600-meter relay, and they stayed records for over 25 years. He, for the remainder of his life, just about coached track and field over in Africa. He actually passed away a couple of days ago in Lagos. He's from California, grew up not too far from Tommy Smith, who also grew up in California. I met Mr. Paul Mooney in the South Miami area, Coconut Grove to be exact, before he performed in a comedy appearance down here in a club. I spent 4 years in the state of Oklahoma. A lot of my classmates in college, undergrad at Langston University, were from Tulsa, Oklahoma. And I visited Tulsa, Oklahoma twice. That particular incident, in my presence anyway, was never talked about. I didn't know anything about it until after I graduated from Langston University, years after I graduated from Langston University. That may be a symptom of the terror that took place back in 1921. That's it. Thanks, everybody, for listening.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. Again, I've not heard anyone say the stuff Marvin Gaye did with Tammy Terrell or After the Dance. He has a big catalog. I've never heard anyone pick a different album and say, oh yeah, that's Marvin Gaye. That What's Going On was all right. But Marvin Gaye's best work is, you heard what's, heard it through the grapevine? Or, never. Focused on racism, white supremacy, generally that is when we are doing our absolute best work. Much obliged for bringing up Lee Evans, because I could not find audio, but I posted about Mr. Evans on Facebook and I'd never heard of him. I knew Tommy Smith, Juan Carlos, but I'd never heard of Mr. Evans, and I saw they had several reports talking about his passing. I'm just reading the one at the New York Times. Lee Evans, Olympic runner who protested racism, dies at 74. Disgrace. Lee Evans, the black American runner who won two gold medals at the racially charged, metaphor, 1968 Summer Olympic Games in Mexico City, and at a presentation ceremony wore a Black Panther-style beret and raised his fist to protest racism in the United States, died on Wednesday. He was 74. The death was announced by USA Track and Field, which did not say where he died or cite the cause of death. The newspaper, the Mercury News in San Jose, California, where Evans grew up, quoted friends as saying that he had died in a hospital in Nigeria after suffering a stroke. Evans was an assistant track coach at a sports academy there run by Nigerian soccer star Segun Oregbami. Ooh, I am a victim. Evans collapsed last week while having dinner with him and other friends. Evans' protest at the 1960 Olympics made headlines, but it was not the one that shocked the world at those games. Let's see, Tommy Smith, blah, blah, blah. Evans was one of several black athletes who had threatened to boycott the games, faced a dilemma after Smith and Carlos were suspended and then expelled for life from the Olympics for their protest. He agonized over whether to pull out of his two scheduled races, a 400-meter run 2 days later and a 1600-meter team relay 3 days after that. Withdrawal, he knew, might end his running career. Carlos persuaded him to go ahead, he said, and in the rarefied air of Mexico City, 7,350 feet above sea level, he smashed 2 world records. He won his first gold in the 400 meter in 43.86 seconds, a record that stood for 20 years, and his second gold, anchoring the United States team in the 1,600 meter relay, run in 2 minutes 56.16 seconds, a record that lasted for 24 years. At our best, addressing racism. The 400-meter race was swept by 3 Americans. Evans took the gold, Larry James the silver, and Ron Freeman the bronze. On the victor's platform afterward, all 3 received their medals wearing berets like those identified with the Black Panthers, and all 3 raised their fists as Smith and Carlos had done, but they lowered them and removed their berets when the national anthem was played and the American flags were raised. They were not penalized. Evans, at a news conference after the ceremony, said, "I feel I won this gold medal for Black people in the United States and Black people all over the world. ADOS people are upset." After winning the 1600-meter relay, the American team, Evans, James, Freeman, and Vince Matthews, staged no demonstration during the award ceremony, although Evans refused to shake hands with an Olympic official. But protests rippled through the 1968 Olympics, including declarations of support for Smith and Carlos by other American medal winners and a decision by victorious Cuban runners to send their medals to Stokely Carmichael, the former chairman of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, who had been named honorary prime minister of the Black Panther Party. Another mention for Kwame Ture. Let's see. And one more. I'm just going to try and get it. Yeah. Lee Edward Evans was born on February 25, 1947, same year as O.J. Simpson and Geronimo Pratt, in Madera, California, the oldest of 7 children of Dayton and Pearlie Mae Evans. His father was a construction worker. The family moved to San Jose in 1962 and picked cotton in the San Joaquin Valley in the summers. Lee never forgot how a field boss cheated them at the weigh-in scales. "I was scared they'd send the whole family away, so I didn't say anything," he recalled. "I've always been ashamed of that." I'll stop there. That sounds like some straight, the half has never been told. Like, I'm on Thomas Jefferson's plantation, not something that happened 1962. That's not even 10 years before What's Going On was released. Like, psh. Lee Evans, 74. I didn't even know who he was until a couple days ago. 74, Lee Evans, victim of racism. Let's see. Other folks that we missed totally. If you have a hand up, line should be open.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings, callers and listeners. Really constructive choice of segments, lots of displays of terroristic behavior and from the system of white supremacy. From the Tulsa survivors, I'm thinking if some of the victims of racism are alive during from that incident, from that terrorist attack, possibly some of the white people, you know, maybe they could be tracked down, and you know, I don't know if they're gonna charge people that owed, but maybe force them to, I don't know, compensate the victims in some way, shape, or form. And if they're not alive, the race soldiers who participated in a massacre, I'm sure they have some grandkids who are alive who can compensate or something, because like, we should be hearing from the white side as well, who participated in this terrorist attack, or their lineage folks, who I'm sure they passed down the story and bragged about it, as white people tend to do about these sort of things. And the race soldiers who shot Anthony, victim of racism, in the back of the head and said it was justified, is to be expected. And it's just, Only an intentional racism by supremacy could shooting a person in the back of the head be justified. And I'm going to need my line.
Justifiable homicide. Absolutely. Incidentally, they could really put the facial recognition technology to exemplary use. Like, they got so many lynching postcards and what have you. Like, scan those images. Who are these folks? Like, they could be identified. Like, yeah, I'm sure some, matter of fact, I know some of these people are still alive. They got lots of these crimes. The white woman, Bryant, who participated in killing Emmett Till, she's still alive. She's in her 80s. I mean, hey, white people got health care and what have you. They got insurance plans and what have you. They are here. They're at Whole Foods and eating their quinoa and what have you. Prosecute. It's tons of these folks. Cold cases, the metaphor that they use. Prosecute. It's no statute of limitations on murder. Prosecute. Absolutely. Let's pull those photographs out, get the magnifying glass, and get, this is not ancient history. Like, this is something they could probably get this wrapped up in like 20 minutes. They do this for Nazis. They drag them anywhere in the world, fine, and they will drag them wherever it is, and let's get the prosecute and do the same thing. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up, I'll give out the number again. 720-716-7300. The code 564-943. Pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Folks, we missed totally if you have commentary.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. This is Victim in Austin, Texas. Just wanted to say that the piece on Tulsa was very moving and really just the epitome of the Black American experience. But I do have to disagree with the speaker from the segment, I guess VGQ, in saying that Greenwood or Tulsa is resilient. Just in my experience, the Black people there are still suffering as they haven't received any type of justice from those losses, even, you know, as described by the living survivors who spoke at that commission. Even, you know, the 20 or so years after Black folks managed to rebuild Greenwood, it was destroyed again by things like the Highway Act, I think it's the Freeway Act, and urban renewal programs. There's some people like to call them urban, like the Negro removal programs. I just also wanted to say that because of the history and the relevance today, the 100-year history, the centennial is coming up. There is going to be a national convention for Black Power there that's going to be held from May the 28th through the 30th, hosted in part by the Elmer Geronimo Pratt Pistol and Rifle Gun Club of Central Texas. I know that you've been talking a lot about Geronimo Pratt, and I really appreciate that from you for sharing his story. One of the events going on is a conference where the theme's going to be titled Never Again. And they'll have speakers there who will be covering topics like the Tulsa history, the fight against the white supremacists there during the massacre, reparations, and self-defense of the Black community. It'll also include an all-Black armed formation. And we hope to see, you know, Black Cows listeners there. Even you, Gus, if you'd like to cover it, that'd be wonderful. But again, I want to thank you for covering Geronimo Pratt's story. I actually hadn't had a chance to listen to all the audio segments, but I look forward to it. Thank you.
Much obliged. That's awesome. They're getting together to do something constructive. I have not been to Oklahoma like ever in my life. So, you know, I'm not an expert on anything related to Oklahoma. That said, I was surprised when the report, when they were talking, as you said, the resilience of black people there, and they had the Renaissance and blah, blah, blah. And I'm generally resistant to that notion with regards to black people and racism, white supremacy, because that's almost a cliche, too, that somehow racism has made us stronger and we just bounce back and it doesn't matter. That, you know, is generally just not the case. Like, if you take away people's property and all that, like, ooh, it can take a long time to recuperate. Some people do not recuperate from those type of losses. It can take generations to recover from, you know, what you've lost or what have you, or even still where you can from generations still be seeing the adverse impact of this event. That's, you know, I feel like much more in line with, I think, logic and evidence of what tends to be the case with black people. Not that this happened and we just moved back and rebuilt and now we had even more businesses and better businesses and more property. And again, I've never been to Oklahoma. I would have to look and study, but that would stress, especially seeing, as she stated, as these people were not compensated. So, But the resilient, that narrative is very popular. I guess that sounds better than just saying we're victims of racism and we've been victimized for, I mean, I guess that's not very inspiring or, you know, doesn't make people feel as good as saying that black people are resilient. Boy, us black people can, we just take a licking and keep on ticking. Like, I don't, that's not inspiring to me either, especially when it's not, I have reason to think that this might not even be true. Anywho, Geronimo Pratt, reading more important than watching television. It has been a pleasure to read about the former member of the Black Panther Party. Let's see. Other folks that we missed totally, if you have commentary to share, they do it the new way now with the highways, as she stated, with the freeway. Now, they don't send a mob of white people in to loot and rape and maim and then photograph and brag about it. Now, this, we got to put a highway right, where do the Negroes live? Yes, right here. We have to put a highway right here. Sorry, eminent domain, but, you know, highways have to be built. Other folks who dialed in with commentary.
Maddie Hurst?
Yes, sir.
Yes, good evening, Gus. Good evening, listeners. Good evening, callers. Briefly, I'm curious, did you ever have the reschedule for Dr. Gerald Horn interview about his latest text?
Been there, done that, beginning of April. He was on the program, I believe, April 5, if unless my memory is bad. Retired firefighter was there. He talked about his high school basketball coach, who it seems may have been classified as white and was deliberately in this position so that he could take sexual advantage of young black male students. This was in reference to a passage in the book where he talked about white men sexually propositioning black boxers like former heavyweight champion Larry Holmes. Yes, we had that program, and all of that is in detail in that broadcast, April 5.
Thank you. The reason I asked is because I was trying to search for it. I was not able to find it on the usual platform that I usually receive your broadcast. Another question I would like to ask, if I may. I have an interesting question for people, the listeners, and you in particular, about gossip. Do you confront people who are mistreating or talking about a specific victim of racism about their information, or do you confront the victim? And I mean,
I didn't really grasp the question. I got the gossiping part, but it was in terms of the confrontation, just break down the options in terms of whom you would be confronting.
Well, I would say, do you Okay, let's see if I can answer the question. Do you confront the people who are doing the gospel, or would you present the information, the mistreatment to the victim, the person that's doing gossip about? Am I clear?
Oh, okay. Let me see if I can. I'm just using this as an example to see if I understand it. So if, let's say, I'm just going to use retired firefighter because he was here. Let's say I go out and start gossiping about retired firefighter. I'm saying, you know, whatever. So it would be, so do I go and confront Gus? You're gossiping about retired firefighter. You shouldn't do it. Stop that right now. Or do I go to retired firefighter, the victim, and say, man, Gus T, I think, might be gossiping. Is that the option that you're asking us? Do you go to the victim or do you go to the person who's gossiping?
Yes, that's correct.
I don't know. We'll hear what folks think. I guess we could take turns, right? Folks who want to respond to that one. We should go in order of people who have not shared at all, right? So then we'll pick, make sure we pick up everybody who has commentary to share. And then after that, we can, you know, everybody else who wants to answer that question about if there is gossiping happening, do you confront the victim and just present the information to them so they can be made aware that this gossip is happening? Or do you go to the person who is initiating or perpetrating the gossip and try to stop it there? Let's see. The number again is 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Let's see. We have about 30 minutes left in the program, so do not wait till the last minute if you think you want to participate, share a word or three. Don't wait till we're about to wrap up to join us. Any folks that we missed totally have commentary, want to respond to our question?
May I be heard?
Caller in Florida. Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. As far as the question, I'm not sure. I don't know. That's an interesting question. I have to give some thought on that. But I wanted to share some things that I observed from the audio segment. The first is the term redaction, because I hear that word all the time, like on the job, and that is an interesting term, especially when it comes to the context of that video footage being released from the victim, Andrew Brown, I think that's what his name is, being shot, and the system of white supremacy. Video footage and images and words can be manipulated, and it does look like that video apparently hasn't been released in its entirety. So I wanted to point out that term. And another one was they were talking about police reports being falsified, and I found that to be interesting as well, because I'm thinking that could have been done for one race soldier to support and encourage the act of white supremacy in another race soldier. And it looks like from one of the audio segments, they said one person got hired in another police department or in another area. And I thought about the quote from Mr. Fuller. I think it's, white people don't get fired, they get transferred. And confidentiality, when there isn't anything exposed about it, white people can definitely continue to help each other out in that regard. And I've heard the conflation as well be used. And when it came to the segment about the black females being surgically operated on without any anesthesia, I think that's what it was. And when I heard about the guy from USC and the charges, I guess he received from a news report, like, where's all of the attention on stories like that that are affecting black female victims? And it really does show the white supremacy in that regard, and how it's only just shown to have concern for white women. And my last one is the appraiser. I thought about that. And toward the end of the segment, or at the end, it says, well, if we just had, or if they had more education, right? I guess the appraisers are people who work at the county appraisers' offices, have more education and a more diverse workforce. Like, they didn't even explain that. It just sounds like more racism being practiced. Because just in our county, 4 or 5 months ago, we just got our first black female property appraiser in 2021. So definitely a disgrace, I would say. And that's all I have to share. Thanks for allowing me to speak.
Total disgrace. Like, that is nothing anybody should have their chest poked out. Like, that's not when Governor DeSantis wants to come for a photo op, say, we got our first black female property appraiser in the Sunshine State. Let's take a photo. Socially distant. What? They don't even do that anymore. No matter. Wait, come on. We'll all chest bump and high five. Yes. No, that is a total disgrace. If anything, I thought that was super important. Like, what do you mean be more diverse with regards to hiring? Do you mean like hire some black people? There we go with that tiptoeing again. Is that what you mean? That I could see maybe having an effect. If you have never had black people who do the appraising, like, yeah, hire black people, or at least hire a number that is equivalent to the population in that area. They'll be represented, as they say, representative, as they say. Yeah, that would be great. And they didn't even get into those details. Like, what are the demographics of the folks who go out and do the appraising? What does that look like? What does that look like historically? What's that process even like to become an appraiser? All that information might be redacted. So we can't share any of that information. We'll have to talk about that at another time and date. And I mean, that's like, you talk about real world consequences. This is not like some abstract doodling or what have you, and we'll just think about this and you called me a name or what have you. She said her property value doubled. Just they didn't say it was some white person who went to Harvard and had, you know, the slickest outfits and everything. Just some white person. Property value doubles. come on. And that's, again, as our call in for this, and that's ignorance. That's, you know, we just need to take a class. We need to get a tutorial, and that'll correct that problem. That's part of why this problem doesn't get solved. Not having logical explanations. Just white people are dedicated to practicing racism, white supremacy. It's expressed in a myriad of ways. Sometimes we don't give these niggers pain medication. Sometimes we devalue these niggers' houses. Just depends on, you know, what we do that particular day, what area of people activity I operate in. 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Folks, we missed totally.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Good day. This is Shadowland, Pennsylvania. Good day, Gus and callers. Greetings, listeners. I just wanted to express regret. I had not heard that Paul Moody had passed away, and I was saddened by that news. I'm happy that he left us a large body of work and a great number of racism was the primary focus of focus of his work. And a lot of it was in the context of comedy. I think we'll be laughing from his jokes and his writing for years to come, but I'm curious. I have been in and out. I'm doing things, moving around, but I'm curious, had anyone spoken on the intersection of laughter and the fact that he's considered like the one of the greatest comedians, and everything he talked about was racism. And if you take it in one context, I think, if you take it in a serious context, it's alarming and disturbing and terrorism. But if you take it in a lighthearted context, like people did with his work, it's funny. I just wanted to speak to the duality, I believe, of that. And I'm not sure if anyone spoke on that, or the thought just popped into my mind. I just wanted to add that. I'll be right.
There are a number of black comedians who have devoted a lot of their routines to talking about racism. Richard Pryor, Chris Rock. I said he's going to be the critical race theorist of the late 20th, early 21st century, maybe even mid 21st century. Chris Rock. But there are a number of comedians who spent a lot of time talking about racism in their... W. Kamau Bell, a number of black comedians, even some white comedians who spent a good bit of time talking about racism. Incidentally, I will say Paul Mooney did a lot of anti-black routines and name-calling of black people. I certainly would not say he was someone who presented as a very disciplined student of counter-racism. I'll say it that way. That was not my impression. He did talk a lot about racism, absolutely, but there was also a lot of anti-blackness and name-calling of black people, which is very common for stand-up comedy. Let's see. Other folks, we have about less than 20 minutes left in the broadcast. So again, no waiting till the last segment. We had the caller who asked about gossiping. Do we address the person who is perpetrating the gossip? Do we address the person who is being gossiped about, the victim, and let them know that this is happening so they can, you know, make whatever decision they want to? Which way is the best way to handle that? I was thinking, there have been incidents where people have been gossiping about other victims around me, and I went to the victim to let them know that this was happening so that they could make whatever decision that they wanted to neutralize this. And thinking about some of those situations, I would probably do that again. There was nothing incorrect about it. I thought it was the correct thing to do then, and reflecting, I think it's the right thing to do now. So at least on that part, I can say that I have done that before. A victim, non-white person, was being gossiped about, so I went to the victim and let them know that this was happening. If anybody that we missed totally, if you have commentary, proceed. Any other folks, if you want to respond to the questions that we have, or if you have your additional thoughts, feel free.
Can I be heard again?
Retired firefighter.
Yes, also former guest, the legendary, it slipped my mind again, the comedian that was on your program years ago, Dick Gregory. Also, just wanted to mention him also, that he spoke about racism a lot. I would say to the question that my instincts would tell me that I would stop the perpetrator first and state to that person, did you inform, and I'm going to say the victim, did you inform the victim of what this you're talking about? And if they told me no, then I would say, then you need to stop your conversation with me and have the person that you're talking about to be in your presence as you're doing this talking. And that's my thoughts on that question. Thank you.
Uh, much obliged, retired firefighter, addressing it with the perpetrator. If so, what would that change any if they're not talking to you? If the person that's doing the gossiping, let's say they're talking to somebody else, does that would you just go address them, or would that alter your approach in any way?
Well, I'm assuming that you're stating that I can hear that person.
Either you hear it or you find out, like somebody, you didn't hear it from them per se, but someone has made you aware.
Well, if it becomes a situation where I found out that somebody was gossiping, then yes, I would go to the victim. But in the case if I either the perpetrator was talking to me, or I can hear the perpetrator, meaning that he or she wasn't talking to me, but it's close enough distance, then my obligation would be to approach that person and state, did you, and just put it in a term of a question. So it wouldn't be, so it reduced the chance of an argument with myself and that person. I would say, did you have this discussion with so-and-so? And it depends on what the answer that they gave. If they said no, or if they didn't say anything, then I would continue on and saying, well, if you did not have the discussion, then it would be incorrect for you to continue the discussion with someone, and you didn't have the discussion with the person that you're talking about, sir, ma'am. Yeah. That makes sense?
Crystal to me. I guess if anybody didn't understand, they can speak up, let us know. But that made sense. Did anybody else want to respond to that question? Or if we had any other questions that folks wanted to make sure that they were answered, or any other suggestions, thoughts that they wanted to share? We have about less than 15 minutes left in the broadcast. So don't wait till the last moment if you have something else to add. While folks are maybe getting their final thoughts together, the program from this past Wednesday, we had two white guests, one non-white guest, we just mentioned the highways, white people deliberately using highways to take black property, knock down black people's houses, destroy black neighborhoods, black businesses, all of the above. Man, those types of programs are so challenging. Dr. Welsing had said some years ago, like, one guest at a time. Like, if you have multiple non-white people, they try to show up each other and show off and all the rest of it. Just have the person there that can articulate their views. Logical sense. But when you have, like, two white people and a non-white person, wow. I mean, we could have had any one of them on the program, you know, exclusively just by themselves and spoke with them for 2 hours or whatever. But to have all three of them, I didn't know how the victim would respond, because, you know, sometimes victims are sensitive about, you know, questioning white people about things. So I didn't know how that would go. The other white person gets to observe and see, like, oh my goodness, who is this Negro? And prepare their responses and such. So, I mean, it's really challenging, like, informative. Glad we had the program. The exchange about good white people, I thought, was telling as well, especially being able to ask all of the different callers about that. But wow, it is all kinds of challenging to have, like, and that's not even just like two guests, but three people, two of them white, one of them non-white. Like, wowee, that is a lot to manage for a program. Hopefully it was constructive if folks were able to check it out, learn anything. And then the subject matter, it's not like we were just talking about nonsense. White terrorism, but using the free, I don't even think most people, you know, think of the freeways. Yes, explicit white terrorism. Let's knock down Rosa Parks' house. Yes, yes. Let's see. Any other folks, commentary they want to make sure they get in? Last few moments before we conclude this week's compensatory call-in.
I have one more small report, with your permission, sir.
Let's hear it.
Yes, I've read where the Japanese government assured the Olympic Committee that there would be severe punishment for any levels of protests of any type in the Tokyo Summer Games, which were, I guess would come up soon. Actually, this is the second time that the Olympic Games was in Tokyo. The first time was in 1964. But and I would say that they probably would not have to enforce anything. The reason why I think that is because in 1968, when that particular protest or protesting was going on, those athletes were amateurs. They were amateurs. They didn't. They was the little bit of money that they did make was quote unquote was not legal, quote unquote. But nowadays, athletes are professionals and they make a reasonable amount of good money for what they do, and they're running and jumping and whatnot, that sort of thing. And for them to get punished, they're probably going to lose their jobs in the process. There was a non-white black female about a couple of years ago, I think in the Pan American Games, who actually duplicated what Mr. Tommy Smith and Mr. John Carlos did in the 68 Olympics. And she lost all of her endorsements, black female. I can't think of her name right now, but she was, you know, born and raised in this part of the world called the United States. And she lost all of her endorsements by doing that. So it's going to be interesting if, you know, by watching the games, you know, I probably would for that purpose also. That's it.
Much obliged, retired firefighter in Florida. There have been questions still about if they're even going to be able to have the Olympics. They apparently have had protests in that part of the world to not have the Olympics because, you know, all the craziness still with COVID-19 and all the rest of it. So it was postponed, supposed to be last summer and all the rest of it. So we'll have to see, you know, how that proceeds, if we're even able to have the Olympic Games at some point this year. But wow, then on top of that, the protest, because as I said, news reports they're protesting right now to not have the games over there. So yikes, that could be
well, the Japanese said they're going to have it. So I don't know. That's the reports that I'm getting, that they are determined that they're going to put on the Summer Olympic Games.
I'm sure they, all the billions of dollars that they invested, because I mean, for the Olympics, a lot of times you have to build like structures, stadiums, and hotels, and all kinds of craziness to host those games. So I am, and it's like years of building and planning and all the rest of it. So I am sure that after all that spending and planning and time and energy, that they do not just want to trash all that and, you know, oh well, we'll wait till he said it was 64 the last time they had the game. So give us another 60 years and we'll be ready. We'll have
No. It was the games is every 4 years, but they actually had the games in Tokyo back in 1964.
Right.
But the Olympic Games itself.
Right. That's what I meant. Yeah, okay, that's what I'm saying. Okay, okay. Give us another 60 years from now. We had to wait from 64 to now. So if we have to wait 60 years, it'll be 2080 something, but we'll be ready to go. We'll just keep all these plans that we're going to use now. We'll just keep them. They won't get moldy, and we'll be, I don't think they're going to think about it that way at all. Like, it's going to be no, come hella high water metaphor, we are doing the games. Like, and if you protest, we'll bust your lip. Like, no metaphor, literally, we will bust your lip. Like, we spent all this money, like, we are doing these games right now. Get over here. So, we'll have to see how all that unfolds.
Be interesting.
Lots of folks around the world will have interest. A lot of people, you know, that's big event for their life, the Olympics. So, yeah. Any other folks, comments that they want to make sure they get in? Gossiping question they want to answer?
May I be heard?
Caller in Florida? Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Gus, had you noticed that the term hate crime is also being used with the Palestinian and Israeli, I guess they say, conflict, or the different groups, I guess, clashing with one another? I don't know if clashing or being in conflict with one another, like in New York in certain places, that the term hate crime was used, and they showed a white man with, I guess, injuries, and they kept using that term hate crime, and they would go to another segment where another black male is shown on camera being beaten by law enforcement, and I think the guy's name was Ronald Green, and you can hear the race soldiers saying that I beat him, and expletives, using where they put asterisks up, that won't show the word, the vulgarity that they're using. But of course, the term hate crime isn't used in that. I can't remember what the name of the term was. When two segments contrast one another, Gus, where I think Dr. Wilson used the term. Did you remember what that term was?
What in context of what now?
When they are comparing one news segment to another, I guess contrast
programming.
Yes, sir. And that's all I wanted to point out.
Yeah, I think that's it. Contrast programming. I think she talked about, or in a number of contexts, I think one specifically, she would talk about it with television. They would put an image of like a obese black person on the screen, and then the next image will be like a really fit, trim, in shape white person. Contrast programming. It's like, oh my gosh, hideous, you know, black people, oh, they can't get it together, and then white people are together working out. Yes, that type of thing. Where in my view, that sort of thing is all the time. If you watch a lot of television or imaging, pretty regular in the system. Hate crime, I had not seen as many of the reports about the skirmishes here, like in the States, where I guess the different groups for Israel or Palestine are doing their protesting or whatever, and then getting into some sort of conflict here, and then that being addressed as a hate crime. And that's, I had not seen that. I would definitely be mindful of that, especially depending if it seems like it's a pattern of them saying like white people are coming away like battered and injured from these events. That would definitely be something to be mindful about if that's, you know, on a consistent basis, and the use of the term hate crime in all of this. I have to pay more attention to those events, because I hadn't really seen that stateside. Ronald Green, lots of those reports, Ronald Green, lots of black people being killed. They even had a report where they redacted it. I guess they were doing the video, and they said the officer, when they were doing the killing of Ronald Green, I was going to sit him up, but I didn't want him spitting blood all over us. Ronald, black male privilege. Yes, black male privilege. Any other folks commentary they want to make sure they get in before we wrap up? Have like a minute left.
I was just thinking about Israel and Palestine being at the Summer Olympics. Wow. That would be interesting.
Whew. Lots of conflict, strife throughout the year. Be alert. That's why I said, you know, consistently, be very alert, be very mindful, moving out and about. It is, man, just wacky times all the way through. We will be back. As I said, we had white vegan filmmakers request to visit the cows. So we will see if we can make that happen and get them on sooner rather than later. And then we can all just be suspicious and ask good questions about why they wanted to make a visit here. In the meantime, just visit. I will post again the caller who's looking for Dr. Gerald Horn's most recent visit. I'll post the link again. It should be in the archives. I was able to find it pretty easily. The Bitter Sweet Science, Context of White Supremacy, April 2021. Great read, great interview with Dr. Horn. With that, much obliged for everyone's participation. Hope it was worthy of your Saturday evening. The Cows, listener-supported, counter-racist radio. Invest if you think the program is constructive. Visit the blog racism-notes.blogspot.com. PayPal button in the top right corner. On Cash App as well, cash.app/$TheCows. Sobriety would be best. Marvin Gaye flying high in the friendly skies. Sobriety would be best. In addition to being sober, man, they said, look here, they said about Ronald Green. The autopsy said the autopsy said the 49-year-old black male died due to cocaine induced agitated delirium complicated by motor vehicle collision, physical struggle, inflicted head injury, and restraint, according to the report obtained from a source with knowledge of the investigation. All that, you can boil that down to justifiable homicide, and this nigger got what he deserved. Cocaine snorting niggers running around Louisiana. You must be crazy. Sobriety would be best. In addition to being sober, if you are going to go out and about, be alert. I would also say not to be out late at night. Generally, more likely that these type of things happen late at night, so try to be in once it's dark if you can. Especially with everything that's happening right now, I would not be in any confrontations with strangers out in public. If someone is being loud and rowdy, you should be thinking, this person could be armed. In fact, this person might have a whole gang with them, armed, ready to kill. You didn't leave your house ready to die or kill, and you didn't leave your house with an entourage prepared to do the same? Exit. You can call enforcement officials or whatever you need to do as you are exiting. This is not a time for random verbal confrontations, kerfuffles with random folks. If you are going out and about, you're sober, you're buckled. If you're driving, you're not on the cell phone, we need to be mindful. And we're trying to minimize contact with the Mark Furmans of the known universe. All of that said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of racism. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. No name calling. Lots of that reading about Geronimo Pratt, like, my goodness. No name calling, minimizing conflict with other non-white people is a major priority for attempted counter-racists. Not name calling is super easy. And not gossiping, since that was mentioned. That's how you can neutralize that problem to begin with. No gossiping. I model that every day, just like I model quality eating. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.